that gay marriage is the new boy in town. They'll amend the Constitution just to keep you down. They say the gay lifestyle is perverted and odd. Well, they should know best. They're always talking to God. Sex and religion, it's sex and religion. That old-time religion should pack up and leave. Sex and religion, give me sex and religion.
News break from the Minuteman News Service.
This is Michael Stinson in Hawaii. The United Nations Special Envoy to Iraq, Lakhdar Brahimi, strongly warned the United States today against using military force in Fallujah or Najaf, two Iraqi cities where tense standoffs continued through the weekend between American forces and heavily armed resistance groups. He urged the United States to tread carefully in Fallujah and said that sending tanks into the holy city of Najaf in the south is not the right thing to do. In such situations, he added, there is no military solution. His comments put George W. Bush, who has associated American planning for the Iraqi political transition with Mr. Brahimi's proposals last week in a press conference at the White House, in a potentially awkward position. The chief American administrator in Iraq, L. Paul Bremer, is waiting for Bush to make the decision whether to attack in both cities, which he has surrounded with Marines. An estimated 1,150,000 descended on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Sunday to show support for abortion rights and opposition to Bush administration policies on women's reproductive health issues. Hefting signs reading Fight the Radical Right and Keep Abortion Legal, determined demonstrators flooded downtown Washington for a day-long march for women's lives. The abortion issue was the centerpiece of the march's broad protest against many policies of George W. Bush, including his stance on funding international family planning. No U.S. funds may currently be used for any family planning agency that mentions abortion to patients. Vote that smirk out of office was a characteristically political placard targeting Bush and to give an urgent wake-up call to government leaders and the nation. Today, John Kerry spokesman Phil Singer issued the following statement in response to Karen Hughes' comments on CNN's late edition with Wolf Blitzer. Karen Hughes confirmed her membership in the right-wing smear machine today with her misleading attacks on John Kerry's record. John Kerry's courage on the battlefield clearly has Karen Hughes and the Bush team nervous about the fact that neither George Bush nor Dick Cheney ever served in Vietnam. And while Miss Hughes has every right to be proud of her father is not running for president. George W. Bush is, and we will stand toe-to-toe with him in our military service any day of the week.
More after this.
Howdy, this is Baxter Black, and if you're like me, you're concerned that the environment we enjoy today won't be around for our children and grandchildren. The Earth's resources are limited. Voluntary family planning improves health while helping slow population growth, and that's good for our planet. Help build a healthy future for us all. Visit www.populationaction.org. That's populationaction.org.
Veterinarians cut open a German Shepherd dog to find she had scarfed no fewer than 28 golf balls. 18-month-old Libby had been coughing blood after weeks of fetching golf balls at a northern England course where owner Mike Wardrop works as a bar manager. When I take her for a walk every day, she is prone to finding golf balls, Wardrop said. She can fit 5 in her mouth. Libby is now recovering from the operation to remove the balls with 30 stitches across her belly. This is Michael Stinson in Hawaii.
Minuteman News Break is a production of TakeBackTheMedia.com.
If Alan Greenspan was a medical doctor, he'd be considered a dangerous quack, and his license to practice would have been yanked long ago. Instead, he's an economist, the unelected head of America's monetary system, and his quackery is not only tolerated but lauded by the powers that be, who've been using him to bilk the middle class. Greenspan's trail of quackery begins back in 1983, when he chaired a commission that persuaded Congress to raise the Social Security taxes of working folks. This radical surgery was necessary, Allen said, to create a surplus to assure that future retirees would get the benefits they're due. Quack. But instead of locking these surpluses away for future retirees, Greenspan left them open to raids by any president needing a quick pile of cash for a pet political project. The latest to make the raid is George W., who dove headfirst into our Social Security surplus to pull out the billions he needed to pay for his tax giveaways to the rich. Greenspan himself told Congress that such tax cuts were necessary to, believe it or not, prevent the buildup of government surpluses. Even though the bulk of the tax giveaways went to the richest people, Greenspan promised that this would not harm working families counting on their Social Security benefits for their retirement. Quack, quack. Just recently, the quack was back, urgently telling Congress that because of out-of-control budget deficits, Congress must now slash Social Security payouts as soon as possible. He urged that every retiree's benefits be cut and that the retirement age be raised. Quack, quack, quack. In his 20 years of practicing economic voodoo, here's what the mad doctor has achieved. Working people had their Social Security taxes raised so rich people could have their income taxes slashed, which he now says means that working people must have their Social Security payments cut. This is Jim Hightower saying, this quack has done enough harm. It's time to yank his license.
Federal college loan rates are currently lower than they have ever been, which means by refinancing now, you could cut your monthly student loan payment by up to 50%. By calling 1-800-2-COLLEGE, you'll quickly be connected to College Loan Corporation. We will answer your questions, help you lower your payments, and secure a rate as low as 2.63%. It's easy, it's free, and so far, over 300,000 people have called. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How are you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too. But who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back. Guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Greetings, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border, on this Monday, the 26th of April. 952 days since our great commander-in-chief declared Osama bin Laden dead or alive. Appears he's still alive. Anyhow, it's a big demonstration in Washington, D.C. over the weekend promoting not just abortion rights. This goes way beyond that because those of you who are old enough to remember, back in the, I believe it was the early 60s, I don't have the case right in front of me, but there was a case in Connecticut, I believe it was 63 or 64, a Supreme Court case in which the law, as I recall, was Chapman versus State of Connecticut, the law that said that it was illegal for married couples to possess birth control devices in their own homes, such as condoms or birth control pills, was struck down by the Supreme Court. And then a little less than 10 years later, you had Roe v. Wade striking down the laws against abortion. And if you look at the behavior of many of the folks on the call it the anti-choice side of it, it's about more than abortion. It gets into being about birth control as well, and it's kind of scary. Anyway, several hundred thousand women showed up in Washington D.C. this weekend. We don't have a final number, of course. Everybody's arguing about it, but in the midst of this, Karen Hughes, who has come back out of retirement to supervise George, who, you know, kind of puts the kind face on him on TV, I suppose, has come out and said that anybody who supports a woman's right to choose is the same as a terrorist. The same as a terrorist. She says, The fundamental issue, this was on CNN, she said this, the fundamental issue between us and the terror network we fight is that we value every life. Now, she fails to mention the fact that George Bush, when he was governor of Texas, signed over 200 death warrants. But anyway, this isn't the first time, David Sirota notes, that the administration has used the terrorism label to attack its political opponents. In February, Secretary of Education Ron Page called the National Education Association, a labor organization of 2.7 million teachers, a terrorist organization because it opposed the administration's implementation of the No Child Left Behind Act. And then you got Randall Terry, which brings us, by the way, in the first hour here, I want to get into this question. Are the Republicans using a familiar big lie technique to bring about a single-party Stalinist state? In our second hour, we're going to get into what are the future of conservative economics and its impact on the middle class. I've got a startling little story from you that goes back to the War of 1812. And, of course, a whole bunch of current and contemporary stuff. In our third hour, we'll get into the best of the rest of the news. Anti-choice leader compares marchers to Hitler sympathizers. Randall Terry, president of the anti-abortion group Society for Truth and Justice, compared those participating in the pro-choice rally this weekend in Washington, D.C., to Hitler sympathizers. Appearing on CNN Sunday morning, Terry said, quote, "These celebrities who have attached their names to the march, their names are going to have a certain amount of shame with it." Remember, Adolf Hitler in the mid-30s had really big crowds and had a lot of famous people saying he was a great guy. Well, let's look at that. Since Karen Hughes and Randall Terry, frontmen for the conservative conspiracy, it's a conspiracy, the conservative machine, I think you can safely call it a machine in the United States. Since they've come out and compared, they've raised the Hitler issue, I would like to spend some of this hour on that. I want to share with you a few quotes from Mein Kampf and tell you a little bit of the history of the rise of Hitler and draw some parallels. And no, this isn't going to be a left-wing paranoid screed. But there's a lot of threads that all come together in this, one of them being the rise of the right in Italy, which brings us to our Berlusconi alerts. Yes, that's the national anthem of Italy, for those of you who don't know. Silvio Berlusconi, the man who was a small-time crook and businessman in Italy, and then bought up a couple of companies, and then bought a radio station, and then bought another radio station, and then bought a TV station, and then bought a newspaper, and now owns 90% of the media in Italy. And once he reached the point where he owned 90% of the media in Italy, he created a political party, ran, and became prime minister. All hail Silvio, the guy who last year, one of our Berlusconi alerts, was defending Mussolini. Oh, he was just misunderstood. Well, anyhow, this story from Reuters. The impact of a labor dispute at a Fiat car plant in southern Italy spread on Monday, with an Alfa Romeo car factory suspending production as police clashed with striking workers. Police attempting to clear a picket line at Melfi led a truncheon charge on protesters blocking the factory on Monday. A truncheon charge is when you wade into a crowd with sticks, you know. On Monday, and at least 9 people were injured in the clash, union and police representatives said. Union representative Lillo Raffo said 7 demonstrators were hurt and were taken to hospital in an ambulance, including one who was in serious condition. So we have this union protest, much to the dismay of Mr. Berlusconi, going on in Italy right now. A man who openly disdains unions. Okay, just some factoids. And how did we get to this? How did we get to this? According to a new PIPA Knowledge Networks poll, a majority of Americans, 57% of Americans, continue to believe that that before the war, Iraq was providing substantial support to Al-Qaeda. 57% of Americans believe that Iraq was supporting Al-Qaeda. They were not. In fact, they were enemies. Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda and bin Laden were enemies. Yet 57% of Americans think Iraq was somehow supporting them. No evidence to that effect whatsoever. In fact, as George Walker Bush said, George W. Bush said in a news conference about 4 months ago,
we've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
No. We've had no evidence. And that still is the case. I mean, the administration will tell you that if you ask them straight up. Yet 57% of Americans continue to believe that before the war, Iraq was providing substantial support to al-Qaeda, including 20% who believe, this down from 50% just 6 months ago, who believe that Iraq was directly involved in the 9/11 attacks. 45% believe that evidence that Iraq was supporting al-Qaeda has been found. 60% believe that just it has not. What was found was a letter from an al-Qaeda guy to Saddam saying, hey, let's talk, and Saddam brushed him off. And Fox News reported the letter and didn't report the brush off, as all the other news networks did. And so I guess what we're getting here is who's listening to Fox News, right? 45%, or at least that's my understanding of it. 45% believe that evidence that Iraq was supporting al-Qaeda had been found. 60% believe that just before the war, Iraq either had weapons of mass destruction or a major program for developing them. And, of course, none of this is true. So what happened? Well, today is the 26th of May. Tomorrow is the 27th. And if we go back 71 years and 2 months from tomorrow, it's a date that most people don't know, February 27, 1933. It's a date well known in Germany. It started when the government of Germany... Well, let me tell you this story without the... You know the punchline here now, okay? Let me just tell you the story straight through without the Germany in it. It started when the government, in the midst of a worldwide economic crisis, received reports of an imminent terrorist attack. A foreign ideologue had lodged feeble attacks on a few famous buildings, but the media had largely ignored his relatively small efforts. The intelligence services, however, knew that the odds were that he would eventually succeed. They had been tracking this guy. He had tried to set a couple of government buildings on fire by putting wet, you know, oil-soaked rags on the outside of stone buildings. Didn't work. The warnings of investigators were ignored at the highest levels, in part because the government was distracted. The man who claimed to be the nation's leader had not been elected by a majority vote, and the majority of citizens claimed he had no right to the powers he coveted. Some said he was a simpleton, a cartoon character of a man who saw things in black and white terms and didn't have the intellect to understand the subtleties of running a nation in a complex and internationalist world. His coarse use of language, reflecting his political roots in a southernmost state, and his simplistic and often inflammatory nationalist rhetoric offended the aristocrats, foreign leaders, and the well-educated elite in the government and media. And as a young man, he joined a secret society with an occult-sounding name. It's called the Thule Society. And bizarre initiation rituals that involve skulls and human bones. Nonetheless, he knew the terrorist was going to strike, although he didn't know where or when, and he'd already considered his response. When an aide brought him word that the nation's most prestigious building was ablaze, he verified it was the terrorist who had struck and then rushed to the scene and called a press conference. "You are now witnessing the beginning of a great epoch in history," he proclaimed, standing in front of the burned-out building surrounded by national media. "This fire," he said, his voice trembling with emotion, "is the beginning." He used the occasion, a sign from God, he called it, to declare an all-out war on terrorism and its ideological sponsors, a people, he said, who traced their origins to the Middle East and found motivation for their evil deeds in their religion. 2 weeks later, the first detention center for terrorists was built in in Oranienburg, to hold the first suspected allies of the infamous terrorist. In a national outburst of patriotism, the leader's flag was everywhere, even printed large in newspapers, suitable for window display. Within 4 weeks of the terrorist attack, the nation's now popular leader had pushed through legislation in the name of combating terrorism and fighting the philosophy, he said, spawned it, that suspended constitutional guarantees of free speech, privacy, and habeas corpus. Police could now intercept mail. They could wiretap phones. Suspected terrorists could be imprisoned without specific charges and without access to their lawyers. Police could sneak into people's homes without warrants if the cases involved terrorism. It was called the Decree for the Protection of People and State. And to get it passed, he had to agree to put a 4-year sunset provision on it. if the national emergency provoked by the terrorist attacks was over by the end of 4 years, the freedoms and rights would be returned to the people, he said, and the police agencies would be re-restrained. Legislators would later say they hadn't had time to read the bill before voting on it. Our story continues immediately after the passage of the Anti-Terrorism Act. It's Tom Hartman, 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
They are delicious. Connoisseurs love them. They're imported from France. They're certified eco-friendly. And they're reasonably priced. What am I talking about? Eco Wines. One of the best-kept secrets in America, Eco Wines from the south of France. Brought to you since 1980 by my company, the Organic Wine Company. My name is Véronique. I select these earth-friendly wines personally. They are made with organic grapes. They burst with life and flavor. Our number? Easy to remember. 1-888-ECO-WINE. Our site? Easy to find. EcoWine.com. See, if you're going to eat, eat organic. If you're going to drink, drink wisely. Drink organic. Our future depends on it. Remember our number? 1-888-ECO-WINE. And that is ECOWINE.
We could build thousands of new schools or hire a million new teachers. We could make sure every child has insurance. Instead, under George Bush, America is alone, spending tens of billions to rebuild Iraq with no plan for success. After 3 years, when is George Bush going to start taking care of America? Shouldn't America be a top priority?
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. New research conducted by the Center for Labor Market Studies at Northeastern University confirms what many workers already know. They're getting the short end of the stick. Since the end of 2001, American workers have had the lowest share of the national income on record, meaning they're producing more and getting less. Corporate profits got a larger percent share of the wealth from increased production. 41% went to corporations, with labor receiving only 38%.
Setting up a radio station? Wondering what software to use? Listen to the words of Mike Chandler of WOBS in Florida talking about the Tune Tracker system.
I love the software. I mean, it is rock solid. It has not burped one single time. This thing has not stopped. And I tell you, I've got some software that I run at two of my other radio stations that cost tons and tons more. One I paid, I think, $1,500 for it. And then one system, which was the Arrakis DigiLink system, I paid $15,000 for it. But this rivals my $15,000 system.
As Mike Chandler said, the Tune Tracker system is rock solid. And the price? Only $349.95 for the pro version with traffic interface, and only $149.95 for the original Tune Tracker 2. Either way, you'll have a radio automation system that performs like systems costing thousands more. For more information, go to our website, www.tunetrackersystems.com. www.tunetrackersystems.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
George, once I'm with you, boy, we finally had our episode.
now you've got two wars, but those have got to make you think. The nation on the brink.
And when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
And welcome back. It's Tom Hartman. 25 minutes past the hour. And immediately after the passage of the Anti-Terrorism Act, his federal police agencies stepped up their program of arresting suspicious persons and holding them without access to lawyers or courts. In the first year, only a few hundred people were interred. And those who objected were largely ignored by the mainstream press, which was afraid to offend and thus lose access to a leader with such high popularity ratings. Citizens who protested him in public, and there were many, quickly found themselves confronting the newly empowered police's batons, gas, and jail cells, or fenced off in protest zones safely out of the earshot of the leader's public speeches. In the meantime, he was taking almost daily lessons in public speaking, learning to control his tonality, gestures, and facial expressions. He became a relatively competent orator, actually a very competent orator. Within the first months after that terrorist attack, at the suggestion of a political advisor, he brought a formerly obscure word into common usage. He wanted to stir a racial pride, he called it, among his countrymen. So instead of referring to the nation by its name, he began to refer to it as the homeland, a phrase publicly promoted in the introduction to a 1934 speech recorded in Leni Riefenstahl's famous propaganda movie Triumph of the Will. As he hoped, people's hearts swelled with pride, and the beginning of an us-versus-them mentality was sown. Our land was the homeland, citizens thought. All others are simply foreign lands. We are the true people, he suggested. The only ones worthy of our nation's concern. If bombs fall on others or human rights are violated in other nations and it makes our lives better, it's of little concern to us. Playing on this new nationalism and exploiting a disagreement with the French over his increasing militarism, he argued that any international body that didn't first act in the interest of his own nation was not relevant and not useful. Thus, in October of 1933, he withdrew his country from the League of Nations and negotiated a separate agreement with Anthony Eden of the United Kingdom to create a worldwide military ruling elite. His propaganda minister orchestrated a campaign to ensure the people that he was a deeply religious man and that his motivations were rooted in Christianity. He even proclaimed the need for a revival of the Christian faith across the nation, what he called a new Christianity. Every man in his rapidly growing army wore a belt buckle that declared, Gott mit uns, God is with us. And most of them fervently believed it was true. Within a year of that terrorist attack, the nation's leader determined that the various local police and federal agencies around the nation were lacking the clear communication and overall coordination necessary to deal with the terrorist threat. Particularly those Middle Eastern terrorists, those ones of Middle Eastern ancestry, and the various troublesome intellectuals and liberals. He proposed a new single national security agency to protect the security of the homeland, consolidating the actions of dozens of previously independent police, border, and investigative agents under a single leader. He appointed one of his most trusted associates to be leader of this new agency. It was called the Central Security Office for the Homeland, and gave it a role in the government equal to the other major departments. His assistant who dealt with the press noted that ever since the terrorist attack, quote, radio and the press are at our disposal, end quote. Those voices questioning the legitimacy of his election or raising questions about his checkered past had by now faded from the public's recollection, as his Central Security Office began advertising a program encouraging people to phone in tips about suspicious neighbors. To consolidate his power, he concluded the government alone wasn't enough. He reached out to industry and forged an alliance, bringing former executives of the nation's largest corporations into high government positions. A flood of government money poured into corporate coffers to fight the war against the Middle Eastern ancestry terrorists lurking within the homeland and to prepare for overseas wars. He encouraged large corporations friendly to him to acquire media outlets and other industrial concerns across the nation. He built powerful alliances with industry. One corporate ally got the lucrative contract worth millions to build the first large-scale detention center. Soon more would follow. It's Tom Hartman, 29 minutes past the hour. The history of February 27, 1933.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report.
New analysis from researchers at the University of California at Berkeley portend a troublesome future for workers in Silicon Valley. They predict 1 in 6 current high-tech jobs in the Valley could be sent overseas in the coming years. For the total U.S. workforce, the risk of being outsourced is 1 in 10. They also forecast a rise in offshoring for more clerical-type work, like jobs involving paralegal skills or the processing of medical and insurance claims.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
For daring to photograph the military's respect for their dead, Tammy Silesio lost her job. Up until last week, she worked for Maytag Aviation in Kuwait, providing ground support for military cargo flights passing through to and from Iraq. This gave Silesio access to the planes, bringing home those killed in action. Since the Pentagon's banned the media from taking photos of coffins, earlier this month, Silesio snapped a few shots with a personal camera and sent them to a friend back in the States. One dramatic photo showing dozens of neatly flag-draped coffins ended up in the April 18th edition of the Seattle Times. For that, Maytag fired not only Silesio, but her husband, David Landry. The two had met on the job, although it's not clear if he was even present when Tammy took her photographs.
We have made history today. CNN says this is the largest march ever.
Marking the first large-scale abortion rights demonstration in 12 years, on Sunday, over 1 million women marched in Washington, D.C. to halt what they see as an erosion of reproductive freedoms under President Bush and foreign policies that hurt women worldwide, including a ban on federal money being used to fund family planning or abortions abroad. Dolores Huerta, co-founder of the United Farm Workers Union, spoke at the rally.
In the Farm Workers Union, we have a phrase that says, every worker is an organizer. Today, I want to say, every feminist is an organizer. So we have to harness the power that we have here today and make sure that every single person is registered to vote and that every single person gets out to vote, because we have to win.
Up to 12 million retired Americans may lose some of their health benefits thanks to a ruling from the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. This new regulation allows companies to cut benefits to retirees when they're old enough to qualify for Medicare, even if Medicare can't or won't replace the loss. According to the EEOC, it was forced to act by recent court findings involving age discrimination. Part of its reasoning rests on the notion that current trends in health benefits call for reductions to be shared equally, and that means retirees losing benefits they've already earned if they may be considered luxuries by current market standards. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. President Bush's so-called jobs and growth tax cut promised 5.5 million new jobs by the end of 2004. But according to the Economic Policy Institute's Job Watch reporting service, 10 months later and 8 to go till the end of the year, the economy has seen the creation of fewer than 700,000 new jobs, way below Bush's projections. And the White House's state-by-state forecast of growth bears no resemblance to the present reality.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman with you, 26 minutes before the hour. Karen Hughes and Randall Terry today comparing the women who showed up in Washington, D.C., marching for the right to keep abortion legal and to keep birth control legal, comparing them with Hitler and Hitler's followers, respectively. Well, that's the administration line. So, looking at the situation here, February 27, 2003, it was the 70th anniversary
of Marius von der Lubbe's successful firebombing of the Reichstagsgebäude, the German parliament building, the terrorist act that catapulted Hitler to legitimacy and reshaped the German constitution with his Patriot Act of the time. A year later, he had seized Austria. A year after that, he had invaded Czechoslovakia and thus came to the end Germany's experiment with democracy. And yet at that time, Hitler was the most beloved and popular leader in the history of his nation. He was hailed around the world. He was Time Magazine's Man of the Year. Most Americans remember his office for the security of the homeland, known as the Reichssicherheitsstaffel. I can't quite say it. And its Schutzstaffel, simply by its most famous agency's initials, the SS. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, if you'd like to comment on this. I've got a deconstruction here. One of the other big strategies that Hitler was brilliant at, he said, in times of war, there can only be one people, one nation, and one commander-in-chief. Ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer. And so he began a nationwide campaign charging the critics of his policies for attacking the nation himself. Most of this was done by his handmaidens, his friends in the media. Anybody who questioned him was labeled anti-German or not good Germans, and it was suggested that they were aiding the enemies of the state by failing in the patriotic necessity of supporting the nation's valiant men in uniform. This was probably the single most effective way that he stifled dissent and pitted wage-earning people, from whom most of the army came, against what he called the liberals and intellectuals. Joe McPherson did an amazing, absolutely amazing thing here. Took a little bit of Mein Kampf and simply replaced the word Jew with the word liberal. The word Germany with the word America, the word Nazi with the word conservative. Well, that's going to push a few buttons, right? I just have to share a couple quotes with you. First, let's take a couple of calls. Rama in Santa Fe is on the line. Hey, Rama, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just was going to let you know, I don't know if you knew this, but Hitler was being groomed to be the second Antichrist, in the sense that they were giving him all kinds of psychedelic drugs and speed so that he could be, shall we say, a channel for the divine, which wasn't the divine energy coming through.
Yeah, but he thought it was, and there were a lot of Nazis who you know, I mean, he was trying to put together a thousand-year reign of peace. When Scott and I were working on this book on the religion of the Nazis, we went to Wavelsburg, which is this little town about 150 miles north of Frankfurt. It's still there. It was taken over by the SS, and as we were driving into town, there's a house with skulls embedded all around the door. And we found an old Nazi cemetery. It was actually taken over by the SS, an old SS cemetery that had fresh flowers on every single grave. We walked in on a ceremony that a whole bunch of old men were doing with black candles and got thrown out in the town's pub. It was really startling.
The entire Thule Society was trying to make contact with off-world beings so they could dominate the world.
Yeah, it was called Thule, actually, in Auf Deutsch.
Right.
Yeah, the Thule Society. Yep. Absolutely. I am familiar with it. Thanks a lot for Rama for the call. In fact, he also methadone was invented in Germany, and Hitler was history's first methadone addict. 1-866-889-889, which is interesting. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. I got an email this morning. Apparently, the left-wing conspiracy crowd are suggesting that maybe when George Bush fell down and hurt his face, and they said he choked on a pretzel, that actually he had a seizure, and his medical records apparently are not public, and but it is known that he's taking medication daily, and there was this question: has he had a stroke? Is there something that we need to know? I think he just got drunk. He's an alcoholic, and it was a football game day, but who knows? Anyway, it's not a conspiracy, and I don't think that George Bush is Adolf Hitler. I mean, let me just put that on the record. But since Randall Terry And Karen Hughes wanted to bring up the topic. It seemed like an appropriate thing to discuss. Harriet in Ann Arbor, Michigan is on the air. Hey, Harriet, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for the show, as always. where to start? If they get to say Hitler, I've been inspired to do some real reading in history recently, a classic by historian Alan Bullock, Hitler, A Study in Tyranny.
Mm-hmm.
He has some very striking quotes from Mein Kampf. And, of course, Goebbels is always credited with the idea of the concept of the big lie. Bullock quotes from Hitler himself, who has this scary psychological insight. One of the points he makes is that ordinary people tell small lies in their daily lives, and they're ashamed of it, so they can't conceive that someone could tell them a large lie about something important, and so that this works.
Yeah.
There are all kinds of points.
It does. And in fact, I'm going to share some of those with you, Harriet. I'm going to get into some of that. So.
Okay. Yeah. And there are a couple of other things if I could quickly try to point out. There's those techniques. There's also something that's sounding very familiar these days. There's a quote from Hitler at a rally saying, "I go the way that Providence dictates with the assurance of a sleepwalker."
Yes, no doubts, to quote
George
Bush.
And then if I could just a really quick comment about what you were mentioning about the term homeland. I mean, I think there were some of us that found that pretty strange.
Yeah, this was a word that Hitler and Hess actually, mm-hmm. when Hitler was in prison was when he wrote Mein Kampf, and Hess was in there with him and helped him write it. And they had been students. I'm forgetting the guy's name. It wasn't Julius Streicher, but Streicher was on their side. But there was a Zionist at the time who was, agitating for a state of Israel and was using the word homeland, to say, we Jews need to have a homeland, he was saying.
Mm-hmm.
And Hess later mentioned that Hitler thought that was the perfect thing to do because the German people were not thinking of themselves, at least enough in his mind, as a race. They thought of themselves as a nation. And a race can have a homeland. A nation has a nation,
Mm-hmm.
And so they intentionally took this word, Heimacht, Heimachtgehen, and brought it out and trotted it out and...
I was interested in how we ended up with it, and I have managed to find exactly one article that addresses this by Margie Burns. It's been on Bushwatch and maybe a couple of other sites. And it's kind of a partial picture, but she describes a Mooney-funded think tank that was pushing this for, some years before 9/11.
Pushing the use of the word homeland.
And CIA contractors and, kind of that sort of a picture.
Yeah.
So, this is sort of what I've been able to find. And, we have a media that, has never really questioned the term.
Yeah, absolutely. And I when I first heard it, it sent chills down my spine.
Yeah, I think a number of us, especially those of us that are, that have some historical knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, okay. Harriet, thanks for the call. I do appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay, do good. In fact, here is Rudolf Hess in 1934 in Nuremberg introducing Adolf Hitler and using for the first time in public the word Heimach, homeland. He says,
Dank Ihrer Führung.
Thanks to our Führer.
Wird Deutschland sein Ziel erreichen.
Now Deutschland is
Heimat zu sein.
It's a Heimat zu sein. Let me just let you hear this again so you can hear it.
Dank Ihrer Führung wird Deutschland sein Ziel erreichen. Heimat zu sein.
And then he says it again.
Heimat zu sein.
The homeland.
Für alle Deutschen der Welt.
For all. And you notice that for all us Deutschen der Welt, for all the Germans in the world. In other words, he was very much borrowing this from the Zionists at the time.
Für alle Deutschen der Welt.
For all the Germans in the world. Für alles Deutsche in der Welt. Amazing. Rudolf Hess there. Here, now, let me just quote very quickly. I believe that our present generation would easily master this danger if they were rightly led.
For this generation has gone through certain experiences which must have strengthened the nerves of all those who did not become nervously broken by them. Certainly in days to come, the liberals will raise a tremendous cry throughout their newspapers. Once a hand is laid on their favorite nest, once a move is made to put an end to this scandalous liberal press, and once this instrument which shapes public opinion is brought under conservative control and no longer left in the hands of liberals and enemies of the people, I am certain that this will be easier for us than it was for our fathers. The scream of the 12-inch shrapnel is more penetrating than the hiss from 1,000 liberal newspaper vipers. Therefore, let them go on with their hissing. Reading here from Joe McPherson's translation of Mein Kampf. By means of the liberal press, the liberals spread the colossal falsehood about American militarism throughout the world and try to inculpate America by every possible means, while at the same time the Democratic Party refused to assent to the measures that were necessary for the adequate training of our national defense forces. The appalling crime thus committed by those people ought to have been obvious to everybody who foresaw that in case of war, the whole nation would have to be called to arms, and that because of the mean huckstering of these noble so-called representatives of the people, as they call themselves, millions of Americans would have to face enemies ill-equipped and insufficiently trained. What soon gave me cause for very serious consideration were the activities of the liberals in certain branches of life, into the mystery of which I penetrated little by little. Was there any shady undertaking, any form of foulness, especially in cultural life, in which at least one liberal did not participate? Or putting the probing knife carefully to that kind of abscess? One immediately discovered, like a maggot in a putrescent body, a little liberal who was often blinded by the sudden light. In my eyes, the charge against liberalism became a grave one the moment I discovered the liberal activities in the press, in art, in literature, in the theater. All unctuous protests were now more or less futile. One needed only to look at the posters announcing the hideous productions of the cinema and theater and study the names of the authors who were highly lauded there in order to become permanently adamant on liberal questions. Here was a pestilence, a moral pestilence, with which the public was being infected. I was happy at last to know for certain that a liberal is not an American. That from chapter 1. From chapter 4, Personality and the Ideal of the Conservative State, the destructive workings of liberalism in different parts of the national body can be ascribed fundamentally to the persistent liberal efforts at undermining the importance of personality among the nations that are their hosts, and in place of personality, substituting the domination of the masses. The constructive principle of American humanity is thus displaced by the destructive principle of the liberals. They become the ferment of decomposition among nations, in a broad sense, the wreckers of human civilization. From chapter 6, the first period of our struggle. This kind of propaganda influenced men in such a way as to give them a taste for reading the liberal press and prepared their minds for its teaching. That press, in its turn, was a vehicle of the spoken word rather than of the written word, whereas in the liberal elite camp, professors and learned writers, theorists and authors of all kinds made attempts at talking. But in the liberal media camp, real speakers often made attempts at writing, and it was precisely the liberal who was most prominent here. In general, and because of his shrewd dialectical skill and his knack of twisting the truth to suit his own purposes. From chapter 15 of Mein Kampf, The Right to Self-Defense. The events which happened subsequent to the burning of that great building prove how the hope of securing the clemency of the terrorists by making a voluntary submission had the most disastrous impact on the political views and conduct of the broad masses. I say the broad masses explicitly because I cannot persuade myself that the things that were done or left undone by the leaders of the people are to be attributed to a similar disastrous illusion. Seeing that the direction of our historical destiny after the war was now openly controlled by the liberals, it is impossible to admit that a defective knowledge of the state of affairs was the sole cause of our misfortunes. On the contrary, the conclusion that must be drawn from the facts is that our people were intentionally driven to ruin. If we examine it from this point of view, we shall find that the direction of the nation's foreign policy was not so foolish as it appeared. For on scrutinizing the matter closely, we see clearly that this conduct was calculated, shrewdly defined, and logically carried out in the service of the liberal idea and the liberal endeavor to secure the mastery of the world. Mein Kampf, the word Jew replaced by the word liberal. The Republican Party speaks in code. Man Merrow wrote this this great op-ed and in the Sagamore. And he says, conservative, here, some of the phrases from the Republican code. Conservative, despite the general understanding, he says, that a conservative would be one that conserves, the right is actually not interested in conserving anything. I've asked nearly every self-declared conservative I've ever met what it is that he or she wants to conserve, and I've yet to get a straight answer. However, from what I have observed, it seems to have something to do with being white and rich. Fiscal conservative. I'll share that one with you right after the break. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 10 minutes before the hour. Karen Hughes and Terry Randall saying the crowd in Washington, the marchers, the protesters, are Nazis? Amazing.
Are you frustrated by your constant inability to lose weight? Are you looking for a natural, clinically proven weight loss breakthrough? Introducing CarboBlocker. Unlike anything else on the market, CarboBlocker is backed by clinical research that proves it effectively helps block the fattening effects of carbs without stimulants. Your body will think you're eating a low-carb diet even when you're not. The results are simply amazing. If you want to maintain the weight loss effects of low-carb dieting for the long run, if you're tired of clothes that are too tight and you want to look fit and sexy, then CarboBlocker is for you. It's clinically effective. Formula is safe, natural, and stimulant-free. And as a special introductory offer, when you order two bottles of Carbo Blocker, you'll get two bottles of Appetite Blocker absolutely free. Call in the next 10 minutes, and you'll also receive two free books, Lose Fat Now and the Low Carb Cookbook, a $100 value. Absolutely free, so call now, 1-800-743-5704. Guaranteed to work or your money back, so call now, 1-800-743-5704. That's 1-800-743-5704.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The Founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hartman.
Are you or a loved one making too many trips to the bathroom? Listen closely because you're not alone. Over 30 million men suffer from an enlarged prostate. That's why if you make frequent trips to the bathroom, have urgency, hesitancy, or a diminished sex drive, then Super Prostate Formula is for you. It was designed by nationally recognized physician Dr. Michael Toplitsky. The results with his patients have been amazing. Reclaim control now and join the thousands of satisfied customers who have had incredible results with Super Prostate Formula. When you order two bottles of Dr. Toplitsky's Super Prostate Formula, you'll also get two bottles of his Super Libido Formula, an all-natural alternative to Viagra to enhance sexual vitality and performance, plus his book, Complete Guide to Prostate Health, and his newsletter, a total $100 value free as your gift. Guaranteed or your money back. If you're not completely satisfied, return it for a full refund and keep his Libido Formula book and newsletter free as your gift. Not available in stores. Call now, 800-452-0978. 800-452-0978. That's 800-452-0978.
Ski resorts could be left high and dry in a warmer climate. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. If forecasts for global warming are correct, many of Europe's most popular ski resorts are likely to go bankrupt in the next few decades. That's according to a report presented in December at the World Conference on Sport and Environment. The report says the ski season will grow shorter and the snow line will move higher into the mountains. In Switzerland, as many as 60% of all ski resorts could close in the next 30 to 50 years. One researcher says the scenario is not quite so bleak in North America. Daniel Scott is a geographer at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, and he studies recreation and tourism. He says ski resorts in eastern North America will face warming temperatures and less snow, but he says they're better equipped than European resorts to deal with the problem.
In Europe, they don't have the sort of extensive snowmaking systems that we do have here in eastern North America, where every ski area has almost 100% coverage of their skiable terrain in snowmaking.
Scott says snowmaking is not as widespread at resorts in western states and provinces, and it's not clear how they'll deal with warmer winters. Scott says resorts that try to compensate for a shortage of natural snow will see expenses go up.
They'll have to make more snow, which will have costs associated with it. I think the average ski area in the Northeast is something like $750,000 U.S. a year. So it's a substantial, you know, amount of money. And if you're doubling the amount of snow that you have to make, well, your costs go up accordingly.
Scott says the news about Europe's ski resorts has drawn a lot of attention, and many resort owners are now looking at their abilities to weather environmental change. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylor Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, 5 minutes before the hour. And where does all this lead? Well, Thursday afternoon of last week, a talk show host in Boston, Boston area radio talk show host, by the name of Jay Severin, said, and I quote, "I've got an idea, let's kill all Muslims," end quote. Now, can you imagine if he had said that about Jews or about blacks or about Hispanics or about white people? I mean, where is this country going when this just kind of slides by? The guy's still on the air. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Joe in Provo, Utah is on the line. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better, Joe. And you?
Oh, you're just right on top of things, man. I really appreciate you. I listen to you all the time. And two things I wanted, a little reflection from you on, if I could. One, do you know who was running this country the first 24 hours of 911?
I have to say I don't.
Well, it was the very person for the first 8 months, and the person that they ignored after that, Richard Clark.
Oh, yeah.
He was called upon by Condoleezza Rice, and he was handed the responsibility of bringing all the principals, the FAA, the Department of Defense, Department of Security. He was in the Situation Room running and organizing this country for the first 24 hours of 911.
Does he talk about that in his book?
Huh?
Does he talk about that in his book?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the thing is, you know, they've had the book for 7 months. They never refuted that.
Yeah.
And, of course, you can go to the records and find out who was doing what anyway. And so I find that very curious that the one person that they ignored is the one person they turned to run this country for the first 24 hours. He's the one that shot President Bush off to a bunker. He put Condoleezza Rice and Cheney in their bunker, and they sat there waiting to take orders from him on what to do for the first 24 hours.
Remarkable.
Yeah, it's very remarkable. And then the second thing is, as a Vietnam veteran, 68-72, I'm really trying to figure out the things. There's all these correlations, but the thing that really gets me is that the ambivalence in this country to this war is the same ambivalence that we had during Vietnam. It angers me to no end that people that don't talk about it, they don't think about it, and they put this young man, Mr. Tillman, up on the screen, who, he wasn't ambivalent about this, right or wrong. He chose to go to war, and he made the ultimate sacrifice. And to me, what's up for me is...
Got
to
wrap it up, Joe.
Huh?
Got to wrap it up. Last sentence.
Okay, we should shut down all the entertainment if we're going to go to war. That
okay,
be,
all right. Joe, thanks a lot for the call and for the comment. It's Tom Hartman. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Excuse me. Pardon me.
Slow down, Kyle. You'll choke on your coffee.
I can't. I have to finish getting the newsletter out before I can do anything else on my schedule today.
I used to have that problem before I discovered the Newsletter Factory.
Well, how'd they help you?
Their expert team of writers, editors, designers, and project coordinators do all my hard work for me. The Newsletter Factory even developed a readership survey that helped me produce the most appropriate content.
Sounds great, but I like doing some of the writing. It's just technical stories and layouts that bog me down.
No problem. In addition to turnkey projects, the Newsletter Factory gives you a smorgasbord of services from design and proofread to edit or full write. The Newsletter Factory can also help with printing and mailing. They keep you informed the whole way. Plus, the process is cost-effective and streamlined, so the Newsletter Factory doesn't have to compensate for lost time or mistakes.
Just like a factory.
Now you're catching on. Call the Newsletter Factory at 800-788-9550 to get started today. Or visit them on the web at www.newsletterfactory.com.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
News break from the Minuteman News Service.
This is Michael Stinson in Hawaii. The United Nations Special Envoy to Iraq, Lakhdar Brahimi, strongly warned the United States today against using military force in Fallujah or Najaf, two Iraqi cities where tense standoffs continued through the weekend between American forces and heavily armed resistance groups. He urged the United States to tread carefully in Fallujah and said that sending tanks into the holy city of Najaf in the south is not the right thing to do. In such situations, he added, there is no military solution. His comments put George W. Bush, who has associated American planning for the Iraqi political transition with Mr. Brahimi's proposals last week in a press conference at the White House, in a potentially awkward position. The chief American administrator in Iraq, L. Paul Bremer, is waiting for Bush to make the decision whether to attack in both cities, which he has surrounded with Marines. An estimated 1,150,000 descended on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Sunday to show support for abortion rights and opposition to Bush administration policies on women's reproductive health issues. Hefting signs reading Fight the Radical Right and Keep Abortion Legal, determined demonstrators flooded downtown Washington for a day-long march for women's lives. The abortion issue was the centerpiece of the march's broad protest against many policies of George W. Bush, including his stance on funding international family planning. No U.S. funds may currently be used for any family planning agency that mentions abortion to patients. Vote that smirk out of office was a characteristically political placard targeting Bush and to give an urgent wake-up call to government leaders and the nation. Today, John Kerry spokesman Phil Singer issued the following statement in response to Karen Hughes' comments on CNN's late edition with Wolf Blitzer. Karen Hughes confirmed her membership in the right-wing smear machine today with her misleading attacks on John Kerry's record. John Kerry's courage on the battlefield clearly has Karen Hughes and the Bush team nervous about the fact that neither George Bush nor Dick Cheney ever served in Vietnam. And while Miss Hughes has every right to be proud of her father is not running for president. George W. Bush is, and we will stand toe-to-toe with him in our military service any day of the week.
More after this.
Howdy, this is Baxter Black, and if you're like me, you're concerned that the environment we enjoy today won't be around for our children and grandchildren. The Earth's resources are limited. Voluntary family planning improves health while helping slow population growth, and that's good for our planet. Help build a healthy future for us all. Visit www.populationaction.org. That's populationaction.org.
Veterinarians cut open a German Shepherd dog to find she had scarfed no fewer than 28 golf balls. 18-month-old Libby had been coughing blood after weeks of fetching golf balls at a northern England course where owner Mike Wardrop works as a bar manager. When I take her for a walk every day, she is prone to finding golf balls, Wardrop said. She can fit five in her mouth. Libby is now recovering from the operation to remove the balls with 30 stitches across her belly.
This is Michael Stinson in Hawaii.
Minuteman News Break is a production of TakeBackTheMedia.com.
A promotional letter from a Hummer dealer excitedly made this pitch. Allow me to introduce you to a fabulous opportunity. A tax loophole so big you could drive a Hummer H2 through it. I'm afraid he was not exaggerating. Tucked way down in the arcane language of one of George W.'s tax cuts for the rich was a provision that allows businesses to deduct up to $100,000 from their income taxes for the full cost of big SUVs. At a time when the federal deficit is bloating, at a time when we should be cutting back on the gluttonous consumption of foreign oil, at a time when pollution from cars is amassing a record level of the carbon dioxide gas that causes global warming, Washington has gouged a loophole into our tax laws that actively encourages people to avoid paying a big chunk of their taxes by buying the biggest, hoggiest gas guzzlers and pollution machines that exist in the entire auto kingdom. Bush's loophole literally requires buyers to go for the huge, most luxurious tanks on the road, Hummers, Range Rovers, Navigators, etc. The deduction only applies to vehicles weighing 6,000 pounds or more. Forget your zippy roadsters, your perky hybrids, your family sedans, your humble pickup trucks. To qualify for this tax break, your road machine has to be bigger than big. How big? Even the Ford Explorer or the Chevy Suburban does not qualify. An accountant tells of a client who was going to buy an Explorer, but by moving way up in price and weight to the yacht-like Lincoln Navigator, he was able to slip through Bush's loophole and save $20,000, meaning he got the bigger one for about the same as the Explorer would have cost, courtesy of us taxpayers. This is Jim Hightower saying, why should we be giving tax incentives to rich people so they can drive a glorified hog for their latte runs? To help shut down this loophole, call Taxpayers for Common Sense, 1-800-TAXPAYER.
I'll just see who that is then.
Oh no! South American killer bees! They're going for my eye!
A swarm of killer bees. That's one thing you don't want in your house. One thing you do want in your house is a better-looking roof with Plictanium plywood from Georgia-Pacific. Other roof sheathing materials can swell at the edges, creating an unsightly checkerboard pattern under your shingles. Plictanium roofs provide a more uniform surface. Plictanium plywood. Build it better.
While you can't see brilliant colors on the radio, you can use them in your business. That's why the Xerox WorkCenter M24 digital color copier printer is attractive to anyone who listens to the voice of reason. The lease price is a low $189 a month. You get brilliant Xerox color for less than 9 cents a page, plus the Xerox Total Satisfaction Guarantee. To get all the colors you can't see on the radio, do the most reasonable thing.
Call 1-800-ASK-XEROX for business lease details. Additional per copy charge.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, for the second hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, the 26th of April. 282 days since Valerie Plame was outed by a senior administration official. A traitor in the White House! Joe Wilson will be on the show in a week or two. His book will be out next month. We'll find out what he thinks about that. The War of 1812. Remember the War of 1812? Maybe, you know, I doubt anybody's alive who remembers it, but the War of 1812 was a boon to American manufacturers because we needed war material. Jefferson had reduced the size of the army. He was starting to slowly build the navy, but it was referred to after his presidency as the Mosquito Fleet, you know, derisively, because it was fairly small. And so while James Madison was president, this war broke out. And I don't want to go into a whole history of the war, but here's what happened after the war. Following the war, the British... And this was the East India Company was at the lead of this. The East India Company, being the corporation whose tea we threw into the harbor in Boston, the East India Company was like trying to weasel back into America. And the way that they were doing it, and it wasn't just trying to establish a toehold in America. It was trying to put American companies, American manufacturing companies, out of business. And the way that they wanted to do this
was by pulling a Walmart. They wanted to sell. They wanted to undercut everybody's price. And so they were actually selling into America right in 1813 at prices below manufactured cost. And Madison had to deal with this. You know, what should we do? In Parliament, there was a British minister. I don't recall his name. And he said, actually, I don't have it here in front of me. Yeah, but I do have his quote. He said, "It is well worthwhile to incur a loss upon the first exportation in order by a glut to stifle in the cradle those rising manufacturers in the United States which the war had forced into existence." End quote. In other words, we're going to crush American industry by selling cheap stuff into America. This was the strategy. This was the anti-American strategy of the British. Now, this wasn't like British foreign policy to ruin America. This was British economic policy to enrich the East India Company and other large corporations in England that were associated with the Crown, with the King, and with the members of the House of Lords and the House of Commons, with the members of Parliament. Actually, this is before the Revolution of 1832, so this would have been principally the House of Lords, and or what was then called the Parliament. And so Thomas Jefferson, who back when he was president had been opposed to, largely had been opposed to tariffs on trade and restrictions on trade, immediately spoke out. He was no longer president, but he still carried a lot of power in the United States. And he said, "We must now place the manufacturer by the side of the agriculturalist." See, he was always in favor of tariffs to protect farmers, but never to protect manufacturers. This was the big thing between him and Hamilton. Hamilton saw America as a nation of cities and factories and commerce. And Jefferson didn't like that picture because he had been in Europe in the 1700s. And he had seen that when you had these big cities where lots of manufacturing went on, what you had basically was a very small number of very wealthy people and a lot of desperately poor working people. Desperately poor working people. And he didn't want that same thing to happen in the United States. But now by 1816, he couldn't, you know, and so he thought everybody should have enough land to be able to be self-sufficient. And in fact, and they were giving away land like crazy, you know, either stealing it from the Indians, taking it in wars, or in many cases, Native Americans dying as a result of contact with the various diseases that white people had brought over from Europe. More died from diseases, principally smallpox and influenza, than in war during the first 100 years of this country. Which is not to say that there were not some pretty brutal wars. I mean, it was a major thing. But in any case, Jefferson said, "We must now place the manufacturer by the side of the agriculturalist." Congress, in 1813, raised import duties from 15%, which where they had been. In other words, we had already had some tariffs in place to discourage the import of cotton, textiles, leather, paper, pig iron, wool, and a whole variety of other goods. They raised these from 15% to 30%, raising the price of British goods. So if the British wanted to sell below cost, that's cool, they can do that, but they have to pay a 30% tax when it comes into the United States. So now it's not, you know, it's not cheap anymore, so now American businesses can continue to do business. Clearly something George W. Bush has never heard of. Anyhow, this is what happened back then. So why am I telling you this? Well, I'm telling you this because we are now seeing the result of the abandonment of 205 years, more or less, of what multinational corporations and their frontmen in Washington, D.C., the cons, refer to as protectionism. The end of protectionism. We are now seeing the results of the end of protective tariffs. We are now seeing the result of the end of the protection of the rights of labor. Let me just give you some examples. This is from the National Low-Income Housing Coalition. This in Michigan. I'm sorry, Massachusetts. As many as 650 low-income families in Massachusetts who use housing vouchers. Now, keep in mind, what this means is if you lose your job, And on average now, people who are losing manufacturing jobs, it's taking them 18 to 20 months to find a new job. If you lose your job, and the new jobs are paying on average 30% less than the old jobs did, if you lose your job and you don't have substantial savings and you need some help to get by for a while, to keep from losing your house, it used to be that you could apply through your state for housing and urban development, U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD vouchers that would help you pay the bills. Pay your housing bills, just the housing. Well, that's all going to change starting tomorrow. As many as 650 low-income families in Massachusetts who use housing vouchers are expected to begin receiving notices as early as Tuesday, April 27, that they are losing their housing assistance. And while the full national impact is still being determined, officials in other countries, communities across the country are planning for the possibility of having to issue similar notices. The notices are the result of a sudden change in administration policy, in Bush administration policy, that leaves many local housing authorities short of the funds needed to cover all vouchers currently in use. See, they couldn't get this through Congress. Congress wouldn't agree to cutting off people who have lost their jobs and now may lose their homes. So the Bush administration has done this by changing a rule, by rule change, going around Congress. On Thursday, April 22nd, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development released a notice saying it would no longer reimburse local housing authorities based on actual current voucher costs. The change, although just announced, will be retroactive to the beginning of the year, further compounding local housing authorities' difficulties. The terminations are unprecedented in the history of the housing voucher program and represent the most current step in the Bush administration's plans to shrink the program. National Low-Income Housing Coalition President Sheila Crowley said, "This is a cataclysmic failure of the federal government to keep the public trust. The Bush administration is trying to accomplish through regulation what it could not accomplish through legislation, with reckless disregard for the well-being of countless families, seniors, and people with disabilities." Boom. Now, it gets worse. In the area of health care, we have some news. I have a story about the Corning plant closure in Pennsylvania. What's happening with the working poor in the United States? What is happening to the middle class of America? What is happening to the middle class of America? Healthcare, for example. In a move that will likely, quote, create anxiety for many of the 12 million Medicare beneficiaries who also receive health benefits from their former employers. Now, remember when George Bush signed the Medicare bill? He said, "We're going to do this new Medicare bill, and we're going to give corporate welfare," not his phrase, mine, but that's what it is. "We're going to give corporate welfare to big corporations to encourage them to keep paying employee health benefits of retirees." Problem was, the way the law was written, surprise, surprise, they can take the money, they can keep the money, and they still don't have to pay the benefits. And sure enough, that's what they're doing. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission voted to, quote, allow employers to reduce or eliminate health benefits for retirees when they become eligible for Medicare at age 65, end quote. This comes on the heels of a year which saw 10% of firms eliminating coverage for future retirees and 71% increasing retirees' contributions for their coverage. Bush had said, "This bill is not going to lead corporations," quote, "to what they call dump retirees," end quote. But it is doing just that. And now you got the AARP, you know, its head, William Minnelli, the guy who whose advertising agency did the ads against Bill and Hillary Clinton's health care policy, the Harry and Louise ads. That was done by Minnelli's advertising agency. He's now the president of the AARP. All in favor of the Medicare bill. And his members are discovering, hey, this isn't what you said it was. And still our tax dollars are being used to run ads on TV saying, oh, Medicare is wonderful. The new Medicare bill is going to give you all kinds of benefits. It's going to be just great. Be sure to vote for Bush. Well, they leave that part out. But millions of our taxpayer dollars being spent on campaign commercials. Everything's okay with Medicare. Right. Well, now the AARP has strenuously objected to this EEOC measure, which they say creates an explicit exemption to the Age Discrimination in Employment Act in 1987. Yeah, good luck. Dance with the devil, you know. It's so here we have the way it plays out now. Once you are old, even if you have a retirement plan that's going to cover you for the rest of your life, once you qualify for Medicare, which right now is the age of 65, your employer no longer has to honor what was a solemn agreement with you when you retired. Even if it's in writing, they don't have to honor it. And guess what, folks? They're not. They're just going to take the money and run. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 20 minutes before the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates block out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
You know that grapes are one of the most heavily sprayed of all agricultural products? Most people don't. But that is why it's so very important to drink wines that are made with certified organic grapes. And that is exactly what we are inviting you to do today. Taste our wines. We select them personally. They come from small properties in the south of France. They are delicious. Connoisseurs love them. And they are earth-friendly. My name is Véronique. I founded the organic wine company in 1980 for people just like you. People who love wine and want to do well by our earth. Call us at 1-888-ECO-WINE. We'll answer all your questions. I look forward to talking with you. Call 1-888-ECO-WINE, and that is ECOWINE.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The White House wants yet another round of corporate tax cuts. It believes cutting the tax burden on business stimulates job growth. But historical analysis of U.S. federal tax rates and unemployment recently completed by the Brookings Institution shows no basis for the correlation. Look no further than the Reagan era. He cut taxes in 1981, and in the following 2 years, unemployment went up. Over the decade, taxation slowly rose again, and by 1989, the unemployment rate had fallen. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Credit card delinquency hit an all-time high at the end of 2003, according to the American Bankers Association. Nearly 4.5% of all U.S. credit card bills are a month or more past due. The ABA blames the situation squarely on the jobless recovery. Many Americans use their credit cards as stopgaps during times when money is tight. Couple that with the scarce job market and a rising rate of long-term unemployment, and conditions are ripe for rising delinquency.
Hey, how you doing? Got a quick question.
Yeah?
Who was Rudolf Nureyev?
Rudy Nureyev.
Rudy.
Okay, I know this one.
Good.
Wasn't he Nureyev? Wasn't he a defenseman for the Maple Leafs?
Sure about that?
Could have been a goalie.
Yeah. Hey, hi. How you doing? Who was Louis Armstrong?
That's easy. He was the first guy on the moon.
Really?
You know, one small step for man.
Sure, one giant leap for Louis. Hey, young lady.
Uh-huh.
Does the name Caravaggio mean anything to you?
Wasn't he the guy
guy that went out with that mob guy's sister until he got whacked?
You know, no.
Are your kids as well-rounded as they could be? Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more about the value of arts education, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Nureyev's dance, Armstrong's horn, and Caravaggio's brush. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and the Ad Council.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Out of bed at the crack of noon, layer the music and have a swoon. I can't stop thinking of your face. La la in the mirror remains. I'm 6 feet.
And welcome back. 24 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Here's a story that just lays it out. I mean, this makes it. People say, well, wait a minute, why should we have, you know, aren't you being a nationalist? Aren't you being a protectionist? Why should we have walls about trade? Why should a nation have borders and boundaries? After all, it's much more profitable for multinational corporations if they can get their raw materials anywhere they want, including labor. And I would say, well, okay, I mean, nationalist has kind of a negative connotation, but sure, I'll cop to all those things because my understanding, you know, in my years of life here, the thing that I've figured out is that economies are always local. Now, there are local economies like the community that you live in. I mean, there's the local economy of your family. There's the local economy of your neighborhood. There's the local economy of your city. There's the local economy of your county. There's the local economy of your state. And there's the local economy of our nation. And at each level, those economies are defined by a very delicate set of variables that create an equilibrium, a balance. How many natural resources do you have? What are the raw materials available? What does it cost to get those raw materials? What's available? What's the intellectual capacity? What's the intellectual capital? Do you have an educated workforce? Do you have inventors? Do you have, you know, what is the average cost of labor as a function of how much labor is available on the one hand, and on the other hand, the quality of life and the standard of living that the community and the society have decided that they want to have? You find countries all over the world, particularly the Western European countries, that say, no, we don't want our employees to have to compete with a girl in Malaysia who makes 15 cents an hour. So we're going to put up tariffs. We're going to put up boundaries. We're going to put up walls. Say, that stuff can't come into our country. It has to be made here. Sorry. Japan does this. China does this. But we're not, since NAFTA and GATT, you know, thanks largely to Bill Clinton and now, you know, beloved by George W. Bush. Because the reality is different economies provide for different standards, let's say. And let me just give you a classic example of this. This is a story by Tim Johnson and Mike Joseph from the Knight Ridder newspapers. Ion China and State College, Pennsylvania. In the end, Ron Welch and other employees of the Corning Inks factory in State College, Pennsylvania, couldn't save their jobs because there was no way they could compete with Chinese workers willing to labor for an eighth of their salaries. Corning closed the factory in June, put 1,000 people out of work, sold hundreds of tons of equipment from the factory to a Chinese company, which crated it up. They crated up the factory, shipped it across the Pacific Ocean, and right now Chinese workers are unloading the equipment and reassembling it in an identical factory in the city of Anyang in central China. It should be up and running by June. Chinese workers will line up on the production lines outside 1,300-degree furnaces as American workers once did. They will melt, mold, press, and cool television screens and rear funnels the same way down to microscopic tolerances that workers did in central Pennsylvania. Same thing. Technology will be same, machinery the same, only the faces will be different and the wages. Welch made $45,000 a year. His counterpart, John Shu, who has applied for a job and has gotten a job at this factory, is going to make $5,800 a year. But with that $5,800 a year, Shu
has bought a comfortable three-bedroom apartment, rides a new motor scooter, relaxes with online video games, and sends his parents some cash every month. It's about local economies. And that's why you say, okay, here's the boundaries of our country. We are going to define this economy. Otherwise, you have this great leveling that happens, and the entire world basically becomes poor, while a very, very few number of very large corporations become incredibly rich. Those are the choices. Those are the choices. Are we going to protect American industries and American labor, or are we going to, quote, compete in the free market against any country in the world that is willing to offer slave labor for 15 cents an hour, or even relatively sophisticated labor for a dollar an hour? Those are the choices. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 29 minutes past the hour.
Think you're not involved in your community? Think again. Spending your money with local businesses is more than an economic choice. It's a way you can have a say in the look and feel of your hometown. By creating a demand for local goods and services, we can ensure a place for the independent businesses that help give our communities character and keep them unique. The American Independent Business Alliance encourages you to get involved. Support your homegrown businesses. Find Amoeba online at amiba.net.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
For daring to photograph the military's respect for their dead, Tammy Silesio lost her job. Up until last week, she worked for Maytag Aviation in Kuwait, providing ground support for military cargo flights passing through to and from Iraq. This gave Silesio access to the planes, bringing home those killed in action. Since the Pentagon's banned the media from taking photos of coffins, earlier this month, Silesio snapped a few shots with a personal camera and sent them to a friend back in the States. One dramatic photo showing dozens of neatly flag-draped coffins ended up in the April 18th edition of the Seattle Times. For that, Maytag fired not only Silesio, but her husband, David Landry. The two had met on the job, although it's not clear if he was even present when Tammy took her photographs.
We have made history today. CNN says this is the largest march ever.
Marking the first large-scale abortion rights demonstration in 12 years, on Sunday, over 1 million women marched in Washington, D.C. to halt what they see as an erosion of reproductive freedoms under President Bush and foreign policies that hurt women worldwide, including a ban on federal money being used to fund family planning or abortions abroad. Dolores Huerta, co-founder of the United Farm Workers Union, spoke at the rally.
In the Farm Workers Union, we have a phrase that says, every worker is an organizer. Today, I want to say, every feminist is an organizer. So we have to harness the power that we have here today and make sure that every single person is registered to vote and that every single person gets out to vote, because we have to win.
Up to 12 million retired Americans may lose some of their health benefits thanks to a ruling from the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. This new regulation allows companies to cut benefits to retirees when they're old enough to qualify for Medicare, even if Medicare can't or won't replace the loss. According to the EEOC, it was forced to act by recent court findings involving age discrimination. Part of its reasoning rests on the notion that current trends in health benefits call for reductions to be shared equally, and that means retirees losing benefits they've already earned if they may be considered luxuries by current market standards. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. President Bush's so-called jobs and growth tax cut promised 5.5 million new jobs by the end of 2004. But according to the Economic Policy Institute's Job Watch reporting service, 10 months later and 8 to go till the end of the year, the economy has seen the creation of fewer than 700,000 new jobs, way below Bush's projections. And the White House's state-by-state forecast of growth bears no resemblance to the present reality.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
The father.
She'll be visited upon the sun.
And welcome back. 26 minutes before the hour. The food line begins to form before the sunrise chill. More than 2 hours before the metal gates to the Care United Methodist Outreach Pantry open, an article by Tim Jones in the Chicago Tribune called The Working Poor. They are the forgotten ones unemployment numbers don't track. Hundreds of people like Teresa Ware, he writes, arrive early because they fear the boxes of food stacked in neat rows will be gone by the time they push their rusty grocery carts to the head of the hours-long line. Ware keeps an eye on her watch because she can't afford to be late for work. For work. These are not bums or welfare queens, as the Reichwingers would have you think. She keeps her eye on her watch because she can't afford to be late for work, not even if the reason is to pick up food. Ware, 49, who makes $7.50 an hour working the afternoon shift at a nursing home, says, "This is a have-to case for us. It's humiliating. We shouldn't have to do this," she said. Teresa and Rocky Ware toil in the ranks of the working poor, a growing category of millions of Americans who played by the rules of the working world and still can't make ends meet. You get any sense of how many Americans are feeling absolutely betrayed by both this administration and the Clinton administration, by the Democratic Leadership Council? I heard a popular comedian the other day say, I'm a DLC Democrat. I thought, oh my. This is the biggest problem facing America. This is a bigger problem than terrorism. Because this is the stuff that terrorism grows out of. Many suggest that the Civil War in the United States wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for the panics of 1845 and 1856. Everybody agrees. Hitler couldn't have risen to power if it hadn't been for the German hyperinflation, which was a consequence of the Treaty of Versailles imposed on Germany, the incredible war reparations that they had to make for World War I that caused the German government to have to basically print money to pay the bills, and that, of course, destroyed the value of their money. They went into debt. Sort of like George Bush is doing now. But that's another topic. Here we have, in America, in the last year, 23 million working Americans standing in food lines. 23 million working Americans standing in food lines. 43 million people are living in low-income working families with children. Other government data show the number of people living below the official poverty line grew by more than 3.5 million during the first 2 years of the Bush administration. The U.S. Department of Agriculture just reported that the number of Americans who don't know where their next meal will come from. Can you imagine living and not knowing where your next meal is going to? I mean, literally not knowing where your next meal is going to come from. Jumped from 31 million in the last year of the Clinton administration to 35 million last year. You want a booming industry, go into the food pantry business. Unfortunately, there's no profit to be made. So what can or should be done about this? What are the options? I mean, this
See, this is conservative economics writ large. This is the reason why you have things like on the home page of right-wing talk show hosts, little charts that show, oh, the rich pay most of the income taxes in America, and they overlook the fact that the poor actually pay a higher percentage of their income in all taxes, when you include sales tax, property tax, and payroll taxes. This is why you won't hear the conservatives talking about the payroll tax at all, which now constitutes 45% of the income for the federal government, because the payroll tax is only paid on the first $87,000 more or less dollars of your income. You make $1 million, you only pay payroll tax on the first $87,000. After that, you don't have to pay that anymore. It's a boon to the wealthy. World Bank President James Wolfensohn on Sunday, yesterday, said, there is a ludicrous gap, this is a Reuters story, between the billions of dollars of global money spent on the military and the amount spent on world poverty. He points out that around $900 billion a year goes into defense spending. Of that, by the way, about $624 billion of it is spent by the United States and U.S. and our allies in the last, and this was 2 years ago, these numbers. This is when our defense budget was $400 billion. It's now $500 billion. Anyhow, he says, around the world we spend $900 billion on defense and roughly $60 billion on foreign aid. It seems to me the most nonsensical thing you can imagine, Wolfensohn said at the International Monetary Fund and World Bank spring meetings. He goes on to say, I suggested humorously the other day that if you spent $900 billion on development, you probably wouldn't need to spend more than $50 billion on defense. The United States spends 300 times more on the war in Iraq than we do on supporting education in poor countries. And people go, well, why do we have to support education in poor countries? It's our money. It's your money. Shouldn't you get to keep it? Well, yeah, except it's going for the war in Iraq. Well, that's a good thing. He was threatening us. Well, no, he wasn't. Well, but that's what George told me. Well, okay, if you want to believe that. But here's the thing. You know how Al-Qaeda gets its power? You know why Hamas is loved among the Palestinians? They run free schools. The Wahhabists, the ultra-conservative right-wing Muslims based in Saudi Arabia who have spread their tentacles all over the world and have these schools all over the world where they're training children, as Tim Russert pointed out this weekend with Prince Sultan bin Bandar, are training children that Jews and Christians are, quote, pigs and non-humans, end quote. They're offering poor people free education. They're offering them the bootstraps they need to pull themselves up. And the price that they're charging them is ideology. They're saying, we'll give you free education, we'll give you a meal, we'll give your kids a meal, we'll give them free education, but they have to take our education. Why don't we do this? We were once doing this around the world. This is what the Peace Corps was all about in some small respects. This was about the Agency for International Development. We were once doing this. And the world respected and loved us. I mean, why don't we just steal the tactics of the terrorists? They can do it on a shoestring. We can do it on a shoestring. It costs nothing. Back about, I don't know, 7-8 years ago, we took over an orphanage, a home for blind children, and a leper colony in Dar es Salaam, India. No, not Dar es Salaam. Dawaswama. I can't pronounce it. Dawaswama. India. And, you know, to feed you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 people and house them and provide care. And the whole thing, it was under $1,000 a month. I mean, it's incredible how far the American dollar goes in third world countries. Now, corporations, of course, know this. I just shared you that example of how Dow Corning is making use of that. Why don't we do that? Why don't we say, okay, we will get their hearts and minds. We will educate them, we'll inform them, and we, instead of teaching them that the rest of the world, the rest of the non-Muslim world are pigs or are evil or should be destroyed, we will teach them about democracy. We'll teach them about, you know, the positive values that our society holds. This is not rocket science. 1-866-889-8894 if you'd like to comment on this. This just is not rocket science. And we are spending 300 times more just on the war in Iraq than we're spending on education in poor countries. If we had taken, can you imagine that? 300 times, and there's only 186 countries in the world. How much bang for our buck could we get with $80 or $90 billion a year, what we're spending in Iraq, going in and setting up schools and hospitals? You would put an end to terrorism overnight. And no, it's not bribing people. The bottom line is somebody is going to meet their needs, and if we don't, the Wahhabists are standing in line saying, we will. We would be pleased to. 1-866-889-8894. Dave in Humboldt County's on the line. Hey, Dave, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Good morning, Tom. You're covering so many important issues. I hope I'm still timely because so much of it's important. On the matter of the extreme poverty and working people in the food lines, I suppose you've heard the latest theory there that one more massive tax cut for the billionaires, and it should trickle down and solve most of that problem.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've heard that theory, but...
Yeah. more than once.
Yeah. You mentioned Meet the Press this weekend with Prince Bandar, and normally I suffer through these Sunday talk shows because I know that the art of being a corrupt administration successfully involves controlling the press, and so for the most part, they don't touch on any hot topics, but I think...
Yeah, hey, Dave, hang on just a second. Let me just... You raised the issue of the tax cuts, and let me just remind our listeners what our fearless leader said almost 2 years ago.
With a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
Right.
Well, see, that says it right there. We have every basis to be optimistic, don't we?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed, Dave. Anyhow, as you were saying, Prince Bandar.
Bandar, yes. I think Tim Russ deserved to be commended. I think everybody should send a note to CBS thanking because he went. He took it on. One of the questions that's taboo, they're not supposed to touch, is please explain to me why several U.S. commercial jets were permitted while everything else was grounded to fly about the United States picking up various Arab people and Al-Qaeda family.
That was a tough interview. He showed the nation, and I think, you know, it's so important that Americans be reminded of this, the fundraiser that the royal family did on Saudi television to raise money for the families of suicide bombers in the Middle East.
I just became a fan of this Tim Russert, and I do think that we need to support him big time if he's willing to do that for us, because I think even the most crazy right wing is going to wonder why. Why did they do this? Why did they let those planes? Because he sure wasn't prepared to deal with it. And I think Russ had explained that the FAA said he got it from the White House. The White House said they got it from Clark. Clark said they got it from the FBI. The FBI said we didn't know anything about it. So somewhere a very high level order came down.
It came from George Bush.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, it's like, you know,
these people were a part.
Bandar asked for it, and Bandar is known as Bandar Bush in the Bush family. I mean,
yeah.
This is it's Saudi money that had, I mean, literally billions of dollars of Saudi money have found their way into Bush family connected enterprises.
Does it also
thousands of millions
though, that there were those who helped Bush create his Pearl Harbor?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is the question that, of course, the Republicans were screaming about back in 1940. What was it? 41 was the year of Pearl Harbor.
was
December 7, 1941.
Yeah, December 7th. It was that Roosevelt had not only had foreknowledge, but had engineered it. And when you look back at the history, you can see that when Roosevelt cut off the Straits of Malacca, which is the shipping lines between the Middle East and India and Japan, that he cut off the supply of oil to Japan. And he had to have known that doing that would draw a response from the Japanese. Now, I doubt he thought that they were going to fly and bomb Pearl Harbor. I'm guessing that he thought that they were going to bomb our ships that were doing the shipping embargo there in the Straits of Malacca, you know, off the coast of near Singapore, off the coast of Malaysia.
I suspect that for noble reasons, Roosevelt felt we really needed to get into World War II while there was time to save England and
before
they came after us.
But I think so, yeah.
I think it was a much less noble motivator that caused Bush to need his Pearl Harbor and an excuse to go in and grab the oil fields of Iraq.
Yeah, yeah. It's and so you're of the opinion that that Bush just kind of let this thing happen because he wanted to have an excuse for his war in Iraq. I mean,
I don't want to believe this, but I think it was orchestrated. I have a feeling that he felt he would go down in history as a hero like Roosevelt.
Yeah, I think orchestrated is a little too strong. I think allowed might be a better word, but I'm not willing to disagree with you because, you know, particularly when the Project for New American Century just a couple of years earlier had said that the invasion of Iraq would only be possible with a Pearl Harbor-like impact, you know, event.
Put that question out there for us.
Yep, thanks, Dave.
Are you frustrated by your constant inability to lose weight? Are you looking for a natural, clinically proven weight loss breakthrough? Introducing CarboBlocker. Unlike anything else on the market, CarboBlocker is backed by clinical research that proves it effectively helps block the fattening effects of carbs without stimulants. Your body will think you're eating a low-carb diet even when you're not. The results are simply amazing. If you want to maintain the weight loss effects of low-carb dieting for the long run, if you're tired of clothes that are too tight and you want to look fit and sexy, then CarboBlocker is for you. It's clinically effective formula is safe, natural, and stimulant-free. And as a special introductory offer, when you order 2 bottles of Carbo Blocker, you'll get 2 bottles of Appetite Blocker absolutely free. Call in the next 10 minutes, and you'll also receive 2 free books, Lose Fat Now and the Low Carb Cookbook, a $100 value, absolutely free. So call now, 1-800-743-5704. Guaranteed to work or your money back, so call now, 1-800-743-5704. That's 1-800-743-5704.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The Founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hartman.
Are you or a loved one making too many trips to the bathroom? Listen closely because you're not alone. Over 30 million men suffer from an enlarged prostate. That's why if you make frequent trips to the bathroom, have urgency, hesitancy, or a diminished sex drive, then Super Prostate Formula is for you. It was designed by nationally recognized physician Dr. Michael Toplitzky. The results with his patients have been amazing. Reclaim control now and join the thousands of satisfied customers who have had incredible results with Super Prostate Formula. When you order 2 bottles of Dr. Toplitzky's Super Prostate Formula, you'll also get 2 bottles of his Super Libido Formula, an all-natural alternative to Viagra to enhance sexual vitality and performance, plus his book, Complete Guide to Prostate Health, and his newsletter, a total $100 value free as your gift. Guaranteed or your money back. If you're not completely satisfied, return it for a full refund and keep his Libido Formula book and newsletter free as your gift. Not available in stores. Call now. 800-452-0978. 800-452-0978. That's 800-452-0978.
creating a greater sense of community might help control urban sprawl. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. It's a common scenario in many American cities. People move from decaying downtowns to suburbia, driving urban sprawl. Milenko Matanovic directs a nonprofit organization in Issaquah, Washington, called the Pomegranate Center. Part of the center's mission is to create a greater sense of community in urban centers to help keep people in the city.
If you make higher densities more livable, people feel less need to flee the cities and be part of the sprawl, which may be one of the main environmental problems we have.
Matanovic says some people move to the suburbs to get away from neighbors who are different. He says building hiking trails, parks, and town centers helps create a sense of community among diverse groups. In one housing project, he downsized individual lawns and created a central park instead.
We've been involved with a project on the east side of Seattle called Issaquah Highlands, and the developer wanted to create an urban village setting in what was traditionally a suburban area. And in talking with people who lived there, we realized that this park, this gathering place, makes a huge difference in the quality of their social lives. Because now, instead of people going to their backyards to walk their dogs, for example, or have their children play, by shrinking the backyards, they all come to the same place.
The gathering place includes play structures for kids and a cafe for adults. Matanovic says it all helps foster friendships and understanding between neighbors. He says by creating safe, usable community spaces, families will be less likely to move to the suburbs. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 4 minutes before the hour. Secretary Tommy Thompson. Hey, remember this story? This was the writing of the Medicare bill. By the way, in the next hour, I'm going to tell you how the same thing has happened with Cheney and the energy bill. We've got now a smoking gun. But the smoking gun with the Medicare bill, Thomas Scully, this guy who was the president of the Association of Private Hospitals, private for-profit hospitals, leaves his three-quarters of $1 million a year job to go to work for the government as a bureaucrat for what? You know, 60, 70, 80,000, 100,000 a year at the most? Most likely. I don't know what pay grade he came in at the department there. But he comes in and he says, gee, I'd love to be the head of Medicare, and George Bush pushes for him. This is the guy who's helping Bill Frist become a millionaire. And he writes the Medicare bill, says, no, Medicare cannot negotiate with companies for prescription drug prices. I mean, everybody thinks, oh, the Medicare bill is going to cost $100 billion more than we thought. It must be a good benefit. Right? It's even more expensive than we thought. A lot of seniors are going, well, that must be cool. No, it means there's an extra $100 billion going from your tax dollars to Pfizer and Ciba Geigy and not to you. And this guy then, his actuarial, Stephen Foster, is doing the numbers and says, well, this thing is going to cost us, actually, somewhere between $534 billion and $600 billion. And Scully says, you tell them that, and I will fire you. Now, Scully says his comments were heated rhetoric in the middle of the night. Well, now, Henry Waxman says, well, we'd like to know, Tommy Thompson, Secretary of Human and Health and Services, what's the deal? And Tommy Thompson now is refusing to make public or give congressional Democrats the Bush administration's estimates of the cost of last year's medication, Medicare legislation. Henry Waxman of California says wrote to Thompson, and Thompson says, sorry, Democrats have no right to review our estimates. And Waxman is going, this is nuts. Yes, indeed, folks, it is nuts. This is the Tom Hartman radio program. Hey, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Excuse me. Pardon me.
Slow down, Kyle. You'll choke on your coffee.
I can't. I have to finish getting the newsletter out before I can do anything else on my schedule today.
I used to have that problem before I discovered the Newsletter Factory.
Well, how'd they help you?
Their expert team of writers, editors, designers, and project coordinators do all my hard work for me. The Newsletter Factory even developed a readership survey that helped me produce the most appropriate content.
Sounds great, but I like doing some of the writing. It's just technical stories and layouts that bog me down.
No problem. In addition to turnkey projects, the Newsletter Factory gives you a smorgasbord of services from design and proofread to edit or full write. The Newsletter Factory can also help with printing and mailing. They keep you informed the whole way. Plus, the process is cost-effective and streamlined, so the Newsletter Factory doesn't have to compensate for lost time or mistakes.
Just like a factory.
Now you're catching on. Call the Newsletter Factory at 800-788-9550 to get started today. Or visit them on the web at www.newsletterfactory.com.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
News break from the Minuteman News Service.
This is Michael Stinson in Hawaii. The United Nations Special Envoy to Iraq, Lakhdar Brahimi, strongly warned the United States today against using military force in Fallujah or Najaf, two Iraqi cities where tense standoffs continued through the weekend between American forces and heavily armed resistance groups. He urged the United States to tread carefully in Fallujah and said that sending tanks into the holy city of Najaf in the south is not the right thing to do. In such situations, he added, there is no military solution. His comments put George W. Bush, who has associated American planning for the Iraqi political transition with Mr. Brahimi's proposals last week in a press conference at the White House, in a potentially awkward position. The chief American administrator in Iraq, L. Paul Bremer, is waiting for Bush to make the decision whether to attack in both cities, which he has surrounded with Marines. An estimated 1,150,000 descended on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Sunday to show support for abortion rights and opposition to Bush administration policies on women's reproductive health issues. Hefting signs reading Fight the Radical Right and Keep Abortion Legal, determined demonstrators flooded downtown Washington for a day-long march for women's lives. The abortion issue was the centerpiece of the march's broad protest against many policies of George W. Bush, including his stance on funding international family planning. No U.S. funds may currently be used for any family planning agency that mentions abortion to patients. Vote that smirk out of office was a characteristically political placard targeting Bush and to give an urgent wake-up call to government leaders and the nation. Today, John Kerry spokesman Phil Singer issued the following statement in response to Karen Hughes' comments on CNN's late edition with Wolf Blitzer. Karen Hughes confirmed her membership in the right-wing smear machine today with her misleading attacks on John Kerry's record. John Kerry's courage on the battlefield clearly has Karen Hughes and the Bush team nervous about the fact that neither George Bush nor Dick Cheney ever served in Vietnam. And while Miss Hughes has every right to be proud of her father is not running for president. George W. Bush is, and we will stand toe-to-toe with him in our military service any day of the week.
More after this.
Howdy, this is Baxter Black, and if you're like me, you're concerned that the environment we enjoy today won't be around for our children and grandchildren. The Earth's resources are limited. Voluntary family planning improves health while helping slow population growth. And that's good for our planet. Help build a healthy future for us all. Visit www.populationaction.org. That's populationaction.org.
Veterinarians cut open a German Shepherd dog to find she had scarfed no fewer than 28 golf balls. 18-month-old Libby had been coughing blood after weeks of fetching golf balls at a northern England course where owner Mike Wardrop works as a bar manager. When I take her for a walk every day, she is prone to finding golf balls, Wardrop said. She can fit 5 in her mouth. Libby is now recovering from the operation to remove the balls with 30 stitches across her belly. This is Michael Stinson in Hawaii.
Minuteman News Break is a production of TakeBackTheMedia.com.
My, my. The tiger can be a testy cat, can he? ExxonMobil, the largest, most polluting conglomerate on the globe, has long used its tiger logo to promote its gasoline, urging you to put a tiger in your tank. But now, the tiger wants to put you in the tank, attempting to jail anyone who dares to protest ExxonMobil's polluting ways. This giant is quick to dish disrespect on environmentalists. But when enviros fight back, the Exxon tiger has a hissy fit and goes skittering to the police and courts to protect it from good old American democracy. The tiger recently turned fraidy cat after Greenpeace and other environmental groups began to confront its multimillion-dollar campaign of deceit and distortions on the issue of global warming. ExxonMobil has waged corporate war against any hint that global warming is a problem. It paid shady scientists to write reports debunking climate change. It ran ads asserting that those who want to stop the emissions are anti-growth quacks. It sent a secret memo to George W. demanding that he get rid of an international climate control expert who was not towing the corporate line, which Bush did. So, Greenpeace launched a worldwide boycott and showed up at corporate headquarters in Dallas dressed in tiger costumes, declaring the place a global warming crime scene. Showing no sense of humor or propriety, the corporation called in the cops to pepper spray, arrest, and lock up the peaceful protesters, charging them with organized criminal activity. Then the tiger dashed to court, getting a compliant Texas judge to impose an injunction against any Greenpeace actions at any of Exxon's facilities anywhere in the USA. An unprecedented, iron-fisted corporate and judicial assault on America's right to peaceful protest. This is Jim Hightower saying, by this logic, ExxonMobil would have opposed the Boston Tea Party. To battle the bully, go to don'tbuyexxonmobil.org.
Only one army believes it can win a war playing children's games. Please support Salvation Army summer camps and youth programs. To donate, call 1-800-SALARMY. Or donate online at 1-800-SALARMY.org. We can't win the war without you.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How are you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too. But who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back. Guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 7 minutes past the hour. Should we be allowed to see the caskets of the returning dead? Should this woman have been fired and her husband as well because she took a picture of them? And it was published in a newspaper out in Washington State, in Seattle, as I recall. Or should she be a hero? Should the rules that were put into place by George Bush Sr. and then ignored by Bill Clinton and now ruthlessly and rigidly enforced by George Bush Jr. be allowed to stand, that we may send our young off to battle? Your opinions, 1-866-889-8894. that we be allowed to send our young off to battle, that they be allowed to die. I mean, you're not allowed to die, but it happens, right? In war. Welcome to war. But that Americans are not allowed to see. We're not talking gory pictures here. We're not talking about the pictures of the corpses in the morgue. We're not talking about the pictures of exploded bodies on the roadside. We're talking about nice, square, white, sanitary caskets with American flags draped over them. You have no idea who's in it. It's not pandering. It's not gory. It's not like the pictures of Princess Diana dying in the street. It just seems to me absolutely outrageous that Bush Sr. put into place this rule for the first time in the history of the United States. And Bill Clinton appropriately ignored it and allowed photos of caskets. In fact, went to funerals. We saw pictures of Clinton with caskets. And now the current president is just maniacally pushing this thing. 1-866-889-8894. Our number, Armin in Florida, is on the line. Hey, Armin, welcome back. What's up?
Interesting that you'd mention the coffins of the military personnel. There's a story out there, and basically what it's saying is one of the big reasons, besides the bad, obvious PR of those caskets and those military personnel coming back deceased in them, is that the international heroin trafficking cartel is using these caskets that are bringing our soldiers back and soldiers from other countries to transport all their heroin internationally.
Now, we know some of that happened during Vietnam, but what evidence do you have of that coming out of Iraq?
What evidence do I have firsthand? I don't have any firsthand evidence, but the story that I heard makes more than logical sense to me, because it's my understanding through just hearing people on the streets that it's no problem for people to pick up heroin. And it's, there's been a big increase, and then it ties in with the increase that you mentioned in Afghanistan.
Yeah, but why,
record profits in this, and then...
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Armin.
It would make sense that, let me finish.
Okay.
You asked me and I'll finish. And it would make logical sense why they're so adamantly opposed to anybody sniffing around different bodies than the military that they can totally control.
Yeah, but we're not talking about anybody sniffing around here, Armin. We're talking about military photographers who have been taking pictures all along. This guy who put these pictures on his website, he's got over 600 pictures that have been taken over a period of a year or two. And, going back to the Afghan war. And the pictures are already being taken. And you take a picture of the outside of a coffin, you can't tell if there's some heroin stashed in it or not. I don't think that that's the issue.
Well, I think that, Tom.
Yeah.
Opinion. I disagree. I think that it's more than the political ramifications of the negative aspects of the war. I think I wouldn't surprise me at all if you got to understand, Tom.
Yes,
Tom,
sir.
You got to understand that this sitting president has lied, and he's used almost any means necessary to demonize the critics and to politicize and engage alliances that he needs.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you, Armin, but I am saying that doesn't mean that a photograph of a coffin that's already being taken by Department of Defense personnel being
Absolutely.
Put in the newspaper
you
means that suddenly
point.
We realize
what
that they're terrible.
Reason? See, Tom, they use Orwellian psychology. It's got to be a reason that can't be pinned for the real reason. That's the best cover there ever was, ever is.
Well, it could be. I think that it's very simple, Armin. They just don't want people thinking, hey, there's people dying over there. I mean, you hear numbers. Numbers are meaningless. 100 people died this month. Well, what does that mean? But when you see the caskets, I mean, it would, you know, it would be even more powerful if we were seen like on Al Jazeera, you know, when we blow up a little town or something, and the Al Jazeera photographers go in and take pictures of the kids who have had their arms blown off, and they show all these very, very gory pictures on Arab TV that's being broadcast all over the Muslim world and creating rage against us, and you know, those kinds of pictures. You know, I think we could have a legitimate debate, and frankly, I'm not even opposed to those kind of pictures being shown on American television.
I totally agree with you. I think that, you know, if you're going to call yourself a free society, and you're free, you know, open to debate and discussion, and the people, their will is paramount, their free sovereign will of all the individuals of this country that are financially responsible for all the good and all the bad that the politicians get us in, I think it's only logical and fair and decent, you know, if you're supposed to be the example of the world, to allow the people to see the truth.
I think these guys are just in denial. And, you know, Bush is disconnected from the reality of death. He was in Texas. He is now as president. It's why he's never gone to a funeral. It's why he won't have anything to do with them. It's why he made fun of Carla Faye Tucker when he sentenced her to death. He has a personality disorder. There's a dissociation there. He's disconnected from the suffering of other people. He doesn't experience it. He doesn't want us to. That's my opinion.
I think that you're pinpointing him fairly accurate. Yes, you'd almost have to be to perpetrate the severity of the what I consider to be crimes that he's optional war. So there's no denial of your philosophy there, but back to my logical opinion, I think that that's exactly what they're doing, because I'm watching out there in the web too, not the local media, but I'm watching the politics of the different countries as this thing's going tit for tat back and forth politically and militarily and good days and bad days and all this. And I'm just, you know, just seeing how swarmy people can be. A lot of politicians, you know, unfortunately in the globe, not just the United States, that rise to the top are pretty swarmy and pretty slimy.
Yeah.
And, you know, amoral, in my opinion.
I agree.
And some of these countries have been known to be, you know, pretty, so to speak, liberal with their drug policies. It's stuff that you find coincidentally that all of a sudden that they're changing their politics.
Armin, we know that it's no coincidence that it is absolutely no coincidence that Afghanistan last year had the largest opium poppy crop in the history of the world, not just in the history of that nation, in the history of the world, and the street price of heroin in the United States dropped from $25 or $30 a hit down to $2, $3, $4, $5 a hit. And we now have epidemics of heroin even in small towns in Vermont. Clearly there's a correlation between the two. And it may well have to do with the constant traffic back and forth that involves the military.
Yep.
You know, yes. But I don't see what that has to do with whether or not we should show pictures of caskets.
You're bringing up that point again. That's the perfect cover. That's what they want. They want to keep the context of the perception very limited to...
Well, then you do it like a magic trick. You hide things in right out in open, right out in the open. You know, you say, yeah,
sure,
here, look at the caskets, and nobody, you know, nobody's saying, well, let me lift the top, please. But you know,
listen, Tom, these people are capable. Give me a break. But beyond that, I'd like to make a statement, and then I'll let you go. And I really appreciate your show, and I very much respect you, sir.
Thank you. Your statement.
I'd like to say it takes an evil media to sustain an evil son of a Bush in the White House.
Okay. Thank you, Armin. Good to hear from you. Always nice to hear from you. And, yeah. In fact, here we go. Cheney's aide in the last hour, we talked about the Thomas Scully, the guy who came in from the For-Profit Hospital Association, went to work for Tommy Thompson in Health and Human Services, wrote the Medicare bill, and then went back into the private sector, back to making millions of bucks. Now we discover the same thing has happened with Cheney's task force. Andrew Lundquist, a fellow from Alaska, who had worked on Capitol Hill for both of his state's senators, became the executive director of Vice President Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force. and was such when closed-door meetings with industry executives. This from an article in the Boston Globe by Susan Milligan and Maud Bielman. And when closed-door meetings with industry executives enraged environmentalists and prompted a Supreme Court showdown this week. Well, just months after this happened, after the energy policy was written and submitted to Congress, which handed billions of dollars in corporate welfare to the energy industry, to the Bush family buddies in the industry, energy industry. Just months after that, this guy leaves his job, opens a consulting business, and 9 months later, he's a registered lobbyist for guess who? Here's just four of his clients. Japan, this from this Boston Globe article, Japan's Cheney aide, now lobbyist on energy. Japan's Toshiba Corporation, which is seeking to build a small new generation nuclear reactor in Alaska and would benefit from the administration's proposed extension of laws reducing corporate liability for injury or death caused by nuclear accidents. Client number one. Client number two stands to benefit from a $16.3 billion Alaska natural gas pipeline that was promised government loan guarantees worth $2 billion in the pending energy legislation, that British Petroleum. Client number three is a coal mining concern in Wyoming that would benefit from a plan to loosen proposed mercury pollution rules for coal-fired power plants, Kennecott Energy Company. And client number four, Duke Energy Corporation, which helped secure a provision inserted in the energy legislation repealing a Depression-era law banning public utilities from making speculative investments, a law intended to protect ratepayers from costly bankruptcies. Andrew Lundquist now back, making his money, and at the same time, Dick Cheney's saying, no, you can't look at the records. Not, you can't know what's going on. Not going to happen, sorry. Ain't going to tell you. It's Tom Hartman, 20 minutes past the hour. Stay tuned. We'll be right back on the True People's Radio.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is a small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
They are delicious. Connoisseurs love them. They're imported from France. They're certified eco-friendly. And they're reasonably priced. What am I talking about? Eco Wines. One of the best-kept secrets in America, Eco Wines from the south of France. Brought to you since 1980 by my company, the Organic Wine Company. My name is Véronique. I select these earth-friendly wines personally. They are made with organic grapes. They burst with life and flavor. Our number? Easy to remember. 1-888-ECO-WINE. Our site? Easy to find. EcoWine.com. See, if you're going to eat, eat organic. If you're going to drink, drink wisely. Drink organic. Our future depends on it. Remember our number? 1-888-ECO-WINE. And that is ECOWINE.
What does corporate power have to do with disarmament? How does working for racial justice affect trade agreements? And what do they all have to do with the Cuban blockade? Having trouble making a connection? It's our specialty. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, for 88 years, connecting the issues for democracy and social justice. Why don't you connect with us? WILPF.org or call 215-563-7110.
Hey, what does this word make you think of? Tchaikovsky.
Isn't it?
So what's the word?
No, that is the word.
He loves it.
All right, who's Martha Graham?
She invented the graham cracker. Before her, there was only soda crackers.
Maybe they're not getting enough art. Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Tchaikovsky's music and Martha Graham's dance. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and the Ad Council.
Setting up a radio station? Wondering what software to use? Listen to the words of Mike Chandler of WOBS in Florida talking about the Tune Tracker system.
I love the software. I mean, it is rock solid. It has not burped one single time. This thing has not stopped. And I tell you, I've got some software that I run at two of my other radio stations that cost tons and tons more. One I paid, I think, $1,500 for it. And then one system, which was the Arrakis DigiLink system, I paid $15,000 for it. But this rivals my $15,000 system.
As Mike Chandler said, the Tune Tracker system is rock solid. And the price? Only $349.95 for the pro version with traffic interface and only $149.95 for the original Tune Tracker 2. Either way, you'll have a radio automation system that performs like systems costing thousands more. For more information, go to our website, www.tunetrackersystems.com. www.tunetrackersystems.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Trying to make his way on. Tomorrow, the Supreme Court is going to rule on whether the papers of President Dick Cheney's secret energy task force must be released. Tomorrow, the White House has been fighting this thing all the way to the Supreme Court. And paying off big oil was a top Bush priority. This here's a little collection here that Jim Leonard put together. I thought it was just great. I wanted to share with you. It's paying off big oil was a top Bush priority just 9 days into his term. Keep in mind, Bush's largest lifetime donor in his entire life in politics was Ken Lay. Is Ken Lay. Guy's still running around loose. And you know, Big Oil made him governor of Texas. Big Oil helped make him president of the United States, to the extent that anybody did. On January 29th, 2001, 9 days after taking office, Bush appointed an energy task force to develop a national energy policy. The task force was headed by Vice President Cheney, former CEO of Halliburton, and stacked with members that had ties to the nation's biggest oil and energy companies, according to the New York Times. Participants in the meeting were sworn to secrecy. Can you imagine? Let's go to a meeting where we create public policy. We're going to write the energy policy for the United States. It's going to determine how safe the country is, how much energy it has, how it's going to be handled, where it's going to go. But it has to be done in absolute secrecy. Quoting from the Washington Post now, from April 16th of 01, this is before 9/11. The Washington Post said that the task force was, quote, something of a secret society. At the start of each meeting with outside groups, task force members requested that the session be off record. They say they will share no documents to prevent information from leaking. The members are expected not to talk to the media, and the few who do are not able to talk about policy. How important was the task force? Well, a terrorism task force was never convened. Keep in mind, as Vice President Dick Cheney, some people, it's funny, many Americans think that the Vice President is like the assistant president. But it's not so. The Constitution gives the executive branch power to the president and gives no power to the vice president. Most people don't know that. Most people think that the vice president has, you know, some large measure of power, you know, just a little less than the president. No. The vice president
has two constitutional responsibilities. One is to be the president of the Senate, and that is to vote in the event of a tie, to break the tie, and to convene the Senate and to close the Senate, to be the president of the Senate. That's one constitutional job he has. And the other is to periodically inquire about the health of the president. Because if the president dies, then the vice president becomes president. And that's it. I believe it was John Adams who said the job of vice president is worth a bucket of warm spit. So Dick Cheney, not basically having a job other than being president of the Senate, was given two jobs when he became vice president by this administration. Two jobs. One was to write the energy policy for the United States, and the other was to look out for terrorism, to manage the terrorism task force and the energy task force. Now, which was more important? Well, the energy task force met 10 times during the first 4 months that Bush was in office. And between the time that Bush came into office and 9/11, how many times did the terrorism task force meet? None! Never! Nada! Zip! Yet! It just did not meet. But between January 29th, 2001 and May 16th of 2001, there were 10 formal meetings of the fat cats of the energy industry at Dick Cheney, in private, in secret, and tomorrow before the Supreme Court, he's going to tell us, or he's going to tell you, he's going to tell the Supreme Court why we have no right to know what was being done with our tax dollars. It's Tom Hartman, 29 minutes past the hour.
Have you visited 100fires.com lately? If not, then you're missing out on thousands of books for a better world. Books about how you can make a difference, about the rights of workers, creating more livable communities, and about how we can stop large corporations from destroying our democracy. 100fires.com offers secure ordering, full searchability, gift certificates, and much, much more. That's 100fires.com. Books for a better world.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
For daring to photograph the military's respect for their dead, Tammy Silesio lost her job. Up until last week, she worked for Maytag Aviation in Kuwait, providing ground support for military cargo flights passing through to and from Iraq. This gave Silesio access to the planes, bringing home those killed in action. Since the Pentagon's banned the media from taking photos of coffins, earlier this month, Silesio snapped a few shots with a personal camera and sent them to a friend back in the States. One dramatic photo showing dozens of neatly flag-draped coffins ended up in the April 18th edition of the Seattle Times. For that, Maytag fired not only Silesio, but her husband, David Landry. The two had met on the job, although it's not clear if he was even present when Tammy took her photographs.
We have made history today. CNN says this is the largest march ever.
Marking the first large-scale abortion rights demonstration in 12 years, on Sunday, over 1 million women marched in Washington, D.C. to halt what they see as an erosion of reproductive freedoms under President Bush and foreign policies that hurt women worldwide, including a ban on federal money being used to fund family planning or abortions abroad. Dolores Huerta, co-founder of the United Farm Workers Union, spoke at the rally.
In the Farm Workers Union, we have a phrase that says, every worker is an organizer. Today, I want to say, every feminist is an organizer. So we have to harness the power that we have here today and make sure that every single person is registered to vote and that every single person gets out to vote, because we have to win.
Up to 12 million retired Americans may lose some of their health benefits thanks to a ruling from the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. This new regulation allows companies to cut benefits to retirees when they're old enough to qualify for Medicare, even if Medicare can't or won't replace the loss. According to the EEOC, it was forced to act by recent court findings involving age discrimination. Part of its reasoning rests on the notion that current trends in health benefits call for reductions to be shared equally, and that means retirees losing benefits they've already earned if they may be considered luxuries by current market standards. Here's today's Dow Bob report. President Bush's so-called jobs and growth tax cut promised 5.5 million new jobs by the end of 2004. But according to the Economic Policy Institute's Job Watch reporting service, 10 months later and 8 to go till the end of the year, the economy has seen the creation of fewer than 700,000 new jobs, way below Bush's projections. And the White House's state-by-state forecast of growth bears no resemblance to the present reality.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. What we know already, the Cheney Energy Task Force. By the way, if you'd like to call on any topic, it's the third hour here. We can kick around anything you want. Although I've got a few interesting factoids for you. But if you wish, the number is 1-866-889-8894. Here's what we already know. Cheney let oil lobbyists essentially write portions of the White House energy policy. An analysis of available documents reveals that the White House, quote, turned coal and oil company wish lists directly into national policy, end quote. That from the National Resources Defense Council. A first review, this is the Washington Post. I'm quoting the Washington Post from March 26, 2002. A first review bolsters the contention of Democratic lawmakers and environmental groups that the Bush administration relied almost exclusively on the advice of executives from utilities and producers of oil, gas, coal, and nuclear energy, while a White House task force drafted recommendations that would vastly increase energy production. It goes on to say that the White House, that from the Washington Post, this from the Washington Post from 8-26-03, the White House collaborated heavily with corporations, but have refused to give any detail about the meetings. The White House collaborated heavily with corporations in developing President Bush's energy policy, but repeatedly refused to give congressional investigators details of the meetings, according to a federal report issued on 8/25 of last year. Specifically, who did they meet with? The Washington Post story. Energy Secretary Spencer Abram privately discussed the formulation of Bush's policy, quote, with chief executive officers of petroleum, electricity, nuclear, coal, chemical, and natural gas companies, among others, end quote. Now, what about Enron? What about Kenny Boy? Well, during a meeting between then Enron CEO Ken Lay and Dick Cheney in April of 2001, Lay gave Cheney a memo that outlines some of Enron's positions on energy. Included in the Enron memo were notes on price caps and their negative impact on energy markets. The memo said, and I quote, "The administration should reject any attempt to re-regulate wholesale power markets by adopting price caps or returning to archaic methods of determining the cost base of wholesale power," end quote. In other words, we've got these monopolies, we've got entire states by the throat. Don't tell us what to do. If we want to squeeze an extra $9 billion out of California, or an extra $12 or $19 billion, if we want to squeeze the ratepayers of a state, just stay out of it. It's not the business of the government, of we the people, to protect the people from us, the energy companies. No, we're much too powerful for that. It wouldn't be right to go back to those archaic methods of defining maximum prices that have worked so successfully since the Great Depression,
But no, we can't do that. Among the previously, this is the Washington Post again, among the previously disclosed meetings were private sessions for one man. One man. Private. The Energy Task Force meets, and the meeting is with one man. Half-hour meeting with Dick Cheney, and then a conference with one of his top aides, no doubt this guy who is now working for the top for the energy industry. Who was that one man who had the private meeting, the private conference, the private meeting of the energy task? Well, if you guessed Ken Lay, you win the prize. And then when finally some of these documents came out, as the Washington Post points out, large portions had been deleted from the documents released last night, but this back in March 26th of 02, a year and a half ago. In fact, a year ago today, large portions had been deleted from the documents released last night by the Energy Department, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Agriculture Department, and the White House Office of Management and Budget. Most attachments were missing, and in many cases, documents were withheld except for the subject line. Thousands of other documents were withheld entirely. As for Cheney's office released only 77 pages of material, and one-third of the documents contained information of little or no usefulness. Of the 77 pages Cheney's office provided the General Accounting Office, two-thirds contained no cost information, and the remaining third included miscellaneous information of little or no usefulness, reports the Washington Post. So we know their priorities anyway. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. John in Pennsylvania is on the line. Hey, John, welcome to the Tom Hartman program. You are live and on the air.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
I believe I have a correction. You said that the Supreme Court was going to rule tomorrow.
No. If I did, I was wrong.
Yeah. They're hearing opening oral arguments
right
on the case. And that will be covered by C-SPAN, I believe either Tuesday or Wednesday evening. If you check your listings.
That should be interesting.
Yeah. They covered some of the case last week, the oral arguments on the enemy combatant case. Interesting.
Really? I didn't realize that the Supreme Court allowed cameras in there.
It was audio only.
Ah, okay.
There was no pictures, so I had to sit there and listen to your television.
Yeah, because on the news you see these artists' renderings of the justices, and
that's kind of what they just showed, the artists, and then had the actual audio for an hour.
Yeah.
So I hope they play the same thing with this. I'm really interested to hear what happened with this Cheney Energy Task Force, and being that there is a.
Isn't this
the Judicial Watch website of Iraqi oil fields?
Yeah, and this has to be causing them to shake in their boots. You know, there's not just a map of the Iraqi oil fields. There's a map of the United Arab Emirates oil fields on there as well, with a list of potential purchasers of their oil.
Right. UAE. Cheney was making speeches all along back in 2002, stating that you know, our energy security policy involved you know, more dependence on Middle East oil, while at the same time saying that we were going to fund alternative means to obtain energy.
But. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, here's Cheney himself speaking to us directly on a secured line from Washington, D.C.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Thank you, Mr. Cheney.
There was a guest speaker here. I work at Penn State University, but Stephen Peltier, who is now a professor at the Army War College here in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, has written several books, was a former CIA top analyst during the first Gulf War. His latest book is called Iraq and the International Oil System, Why America Went to War in the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite interesting. Basically, it's all about the oil and control of the Gulf, not so much securing Iraq's oil. What he claims is.
Oh yeah. No, this is so obvious. I mean, you know, what do you call it? The New American Century, the Committee for New American Project for a New American Century. You know, they were pretty explicit about this. You know, our
security as long as we are importing half of our oil. I mean, it was 1974 was when we hit peak oil. Up until then, the United States was exporting oil, and or had the ability to anyway. And when we hit peak oil, I mean, I think we stopped our major exports of oil back in the 50s. But in any case, when we hit peak oil, we were like, you know, okay, what are we going to do? And now we're in a situation where we have to import oil in order to maintain our military, in order to maintain our you know, so your car can drive down the street, I mean, basically. And so they said, you know, if our security is going to depend on this, then we need to secure the Middle East. And we need to put the fear of God into all those countries, including the Saudis, including the Libyans. You notice three American oil companies announced today that they were going into Libya. It was in today's Wall Street Journal. I don't remember the exact names, so I shouldn't cite names. But anyhow, there were three American oil companies, and you know, it's you're absolutely right. It's all about oil. It is all about oil. John, real quick question before I move on to the next caller. Toomey and Spector, you're calling from Pennsylvania. Where are you in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, near Harrisburg, just outside of Harrisburg.
Yeah, what do you think's going to happen in that race? What's you're on the ground there? What's your sense?
Yeah, Bush was across the street here last week. You know, talking up Senator Spector. So
really, was there a free speech zone where they heard the protesters?
Actually, there was. Yeah, down the block here, there were some protesters, but they were you know, well away from the convention center where Bush was speaking.
Yeah.
So yeah, they weren't able to be anywhere near there.
So who do you think is going to win?
I don't know.
Primary's tomorrow, isn't it?
Yeah, it is tomorrow.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's going to be a close one. I wouldn't guess.
Wouldn't put money on either one of them.
Yeah.
Huh? Okay. John, thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
All right, thanks.
Great to hear from you. It's 16 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, indeed. And Chris in New Mexico is on the line. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Not much. Talking about the Energy Task Force case in front of the Supreme Court, day before yesterday I had an opportunity on a different radio program to talk to one of the lawyers for Judicial Watch.
Oh, interesting.
I happened to bring up the instance of Antonin Scalia and Dick Cheney. The man backed off so fast you could hear the vacuum pop as he backed away from the telephone. I should have known. He probably didn't want to speak disparagingly of Antonin Scalia before he was going to try a case before him. But still, has that gone? I mean, that's not gotten a lot of play lately. And if this is going to be going into, I guess, litigation.
Yeah, no, Scalia wrote his whole long 21-page excuse, and in large, you know, big chunks of it were printed in the Wall Street Journal. I mean, the conservatives are all just, oh, isn't it wonderful? Isn't he thoughtful? Isn't he insightful? And obviously he has no conflict of interest. And what everybody is missing is that the issue is not, does this judge have a conflict of interest? That is not the issue. The issue is, would a citizen conclude that there's a possibility, an appearance of a conflict of interest.
True. I'm just kind of wondering what the Vegas odds on are, how Scalia is going to rule.
Yeah. Well, you really wonder? You really wonder?
I mean, have a good day, man. Have a good day.
Thanks a lot, Chris. I appreciate it. Of course you were being facetious. It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. Both the law and the policy are so clear. Yeah, I mean, for 227 years, the judges have a responsibility to avoid the appearance of bias and impropriety. I mean, if they have bias or impropriety, then you're talking about it's a crime. But just they should recuse themselves if there is the appearance of it. And Scalia never once talked about that in his 21-page, aren't I wonderful, I'm going to do what I want, take a leap, all my critics, they're just out to get me, blah, 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 blah. Just and this is the guy, by the way, I'm telling you, when Rehnquist retires, if there's a Republican in the White House, Scalia is going to be the next Supreme Court Chief Justice. You can take that to the bank. And that's one of the reasons why it is this man is an absolute extremist. You talk about judicial activism, and that's why it is so important that we register to vote and that in November, no matter what you may think of John Kerry, no matter what, you know, warts he may have, I know a lot of progressives are going, oh, no, he's selling out. He's moving to the middle. Hey, if that's what it takes to get him elected, I'm all in favor of it. I frankly think it's a mistake because I don't think that that's what's going to get him elected. But I may well be wrong. I mean, he knows probably more about how to run a political campaign. Well, certainly knows more about how to run a political campaign than I do. I mean, I'm just, you know, standing on the outside looking in, and it seems like everybody I've ever voted for is lost. So, you know, what do I know? But it's still, it's anybody, you know, John Kerry is not going to make Antonin Scalia the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. It ain't going to happen. And if for no other reason than that, we should work to get this guy into office. Here we have the IRS using taxpayer. This is amazing. Remember a year or two ago with the first tax cuts, and they sent out those checks, those $300 checks. I think it was 2 years ago. And it came with a letter that was paid for by you and me. That was printed and, you know, by the IRS, that said something to the effect of, isn't it wonderful that, I mean, it didn't make the value judgment, but it was implicit. Isn't it wonderful that the Bush administration has pushed through this tax cut so that we can present you with this advance on your tax cut? And it was, you know, it was a commercial for the Republicans. And it helped them in 2002. These guys are so careful about how they time these things. Well, here we go again. The IRS is using taxpayer money to promote partisan propaganda. Recently, the Department of Treasury appended the following message to IRS press releases. Now, get this. This is an IRS press release. And I quote, "America has a choice. It can continue to grow the economy and create new jobs as the president's policies are doing, or it can raise taxes on American families and small businesses, hurting economic recovery and future job creation." End quote. You believe that? I mean, Bill Clinton said, hey, we need to have a balanced budget. That's more important than having tax breaks. Raise taxes, and what did you get? Jobs! But no, the IRS, this is outrageous. Paid for with our tax dollars. This is Tom Hartman. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Stay tuned.
Are you frustrated by your constant inability to lose weight? Are you looking for a natural, clinically proven weight loss breakthrough? Introducing CarboBlocker. Unlike anything else on the market, CarboBlocker is backed by clinical research that proves it effectively helps block the fattening effects of carbs without stimulants. Your body will think you're eating a low-carb diet even when you're not. The results are simply amazing. If you want to maintain the weight loss effects of low-carb dieting for the long run, if you're tired of clothes that are too tight and you want to look fit and sexy, then CarboBlocker is for you. It's clinically effective. Formula is safe, natural, and stimulant-free. And as a special introductory offer, when you order two bottles of Carbo Blocker, you'll get two bottles of Appetite Blocker absolutely free. Call in the next 10 minutes, and you'll also receive two free books, Lose Fat Now and the Low Carb Cookbook, a $100 value, absolutely free. So call now, 1-800-743-5704. Guaranteed to work or your money back, so call now, 1-800-743-5704. That's 1-800-743-5704.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The Founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hartman.
Are you or a loved one making too many trips to the bathroom? Listen closely because you're not alone. Over 30 million men suffer from an enlarged prostate. That's why if you make frequent trips to the bathroom, have urgency, hesitancy, or a diminished sex drive, then Super Prostate Formula is for you. It was designed by nationally recognized physician Dr. Michael Toplitsky. The results with his patients have been amazing. Reclaim control now and join the thousands of satisfied customers who have had incredible results with Super Prostate Formula. When you order 2 bottles of Dr. Toplitsky's Super Prostate Formula, you'll also get 2 bottles of his Super Libido Formula, an all-natural alternative to Viagra to enhance sexual vitality and performance, plus his book, Complete Guide to Prostate Health, and his newsletter, a total $100 value free as your gift. Guaranteed or your money back. If you're not completely satisfied, return it for a full refund and keep his Libido Formula book and newsletter free as your gift. Not available in stores. Call now. 800-452-0978. 800-452-0978. That's 800-452-0978.
A Seattle area urban designer creates community spaces that blend with the environment. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Milenko Matanovic designs gathering spaces and parks for communities around Seattle, Washington. His aim is to make shelters, benches, and other structures blend with their surroundings.
The design needs to rise out of the space, out of the natural conditions, rather than be imposed onto them. And so we're very concerned with creating metaphors that both reflect the natural condition of the land, but also the human condition of the community.
Matanovic directs the Pomegranate Center, a nonprofit organization that designs community spaces. He uses materials found in the original landscape, like rocks and trees, to create environmentally friendly gathering places. And in a recent project done in Tacoma, Washington, Matanovic salvaged materials from historical parts of the city. He created a venue for performances and gatherings. The construction was done by local volunteers
who created this extraordinary series of shelters inlaid with copper that we salvaged from the old Union Station in Tacoma. And we utilized cobblestones from the old streets of Tacoma and granite curb stones that used to define sidewalks. And we were able to use them to design this pretty extraordinary gathering circle and 3 linked shelters that serve as focal points for the community.
Matanovic says it's important to make gathering places that fit the native landscape, but he says the project must also accommodate the needs of a community. To see photos of Matanovic's work, visit his website. It's pomegranate.org. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
God on our side.
God on his side.
Yes, thank you, Joan. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 4 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. We're broadcasting live coast-to-coast on terrestrial radio stations beaming around the planet on the Sirius Satellite Network. I'm sorry, around the United States. Beaming around the planet on radiopower.org. Archives supported by whiteRoseSociety.org. White Rose Society is doing a fundraising drive right now, by the way. Let me encourage you to check that out and to donate to their cause. They're doing a great work. And also let you know that we have archives of this program that have been selectively edited by Mike Toth, and they're on our website. You go to tomhartman.com and just click on the archive button, and it'll take you to them. Some great, great work that Michael has done, and is much, much appreciated. Vice President Dick Cheney is delivering a speech in Missouri today. He's going to be attacking John Kerry for his votes on defense spending back in the 1980s and in the early 1990s. Yet when you look back then, you find that Cheney was in Congress back then. During the height of the Cold War tensions, it was Cheney who told the Washington Post on December 16, 1984, that if President Reagan, quote, doesn't really cut defense, he becomes the number one special pleader in town, end quote. Cheney said, quote, the president has got to reach out and take a whack at everything to be credible, end quote, and said that absent a raid on Social Security or a tax increase, quote, you've got to hit defense, end quote. Six years later, on January 1st of 1990, it was Cheney who proudly told Congress, quote, since I became secretary, we've been through a fairly major process of reducing the defense budget, end quote. He bragged that during the first year of his tenure, he, quote, would cut almost $65 billion out of the five-year defense program, end quote, and the subsequent proposals would, quote, take another $167 billion out, end quote. He trumpeted the fact that, quote, we're recommending base closures, we're talking about force structure cuts, and we've got a military construction freeze, end quote. And as the 8-4-91 New York Times note, Cheney tried to move to reduce active duty troop strength from 2.2 million to 1.6 million while making deep cuts in the reserves and the National Guard, cuts that we are now being haunted by. Thanks for listening today. It's the end of the program, the end of the Friday here. Thanks to Louise for producing the show. Thanks to Rama Schneider for coming in and answering our phones and engineering the program. Thanks to our sponsors. Thanks to Shelby at radiopower.org and Ben at White Rose Society and Michael Toth. Thanks to our listeners. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up. See you tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Excuse me. Pardon me.
Slow down, Kyle. You'll choke on your coffee.
Can't. Have to finish getting the newsletter out before I can do anything else on my schedule today.
I used to have that problem before I discovered the Newsletter Factory.
Well, how'd they help you?
Their expert team of writers, editors, designers, and project coordinators do all my hard work for me. The Newsletter Factory even developed a readership survey that helped me produce the most appropriate content.
Sounds great, but I like doing some of the writing. It's just technical stories and layouts that bog me down.
No problem. In addition to turnkey projects, the Newsletter Factory gives you a smorgasbord of services from design and proofread to edit or full write. The Newsletter Factory can also help with printing.